Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
They don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it in the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to talk with our good friend, attorney Erwin Aronson, about the Hershey situation, the whole right-to-work nonsense that's going on here in the state. You know, the unemployment comp thing, so much to get with him here in this here in Pennsylvania to go over. That'll be good. Don Siegel, vice president of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, District 3, is going to be here talking about his piece in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette on the free trade deals that Obama is pushing. Also, we're going to get an update on the Verizon situation. And also, Joshua Holland, editor and senior writer over at Alternet, is going to be talking about how we create jobs. You know, bring back manufacturing, something we've been talking about here on the program for quite some time. And look, it doesn't take a genius to figure this stuff out. We can only have an economy that is based on me cutting your grass or cutting your hair or washing your dog until finally it all collapses. You can only have this service-based economy for so long, and it will only create so much wealth. And that wealth generally goes upward, up to the people who are exploiting the people who are working. You know, you look at this Hershey deal, and I got to be honest, this is exactly what's wrong with this country. This, from top to bottom, front to back, no matter how you look at this Hershey deal, it stinks. It's rotten. It stinks. But you know what? This is what they get away with. So you look at the mainstream media here in the area, and the headline read, the Hershey Company give foreign students paid vacation. They give it to them. Here you go. We're so grateful to you. We're going to give you this wonderful gift because, you know, we understand. And you look at all the finger pointing that's going on. You know, you go from top to bottom. If it isn't the company that brought them here, it's the company who staffed the employees, it's the company who managed the warehouse, and it's Hershey themselves. And yesterday, I guess Hershey finally woke up and said, this is all going to land on our shoulders. We had better do something. So evidently, according to the newspaper, they gave the edict to their subcontractors. You need to make peace with these students. And, you know, they gave them a sweet deal, according to the paper. It's a sweet deal. 1 week paid vacation. Ooh, sweet. What it didn't bother to tell you, and this is one of those things that grabs my attention, what they didn't bother to tell you is that there were 4 federal probes into what's going on. They have got to figure out quickly how to put this down, how to cool this all down, because, you know, once the feds start poking around, once you start getting OSHA in, once you start getting the Department of Labor in, once you start getting the Department of Justice, the State Department in, once you start getting all these agencies looking at you, I don't care how sweet your business is. I don't care how wonderful you think you treat your employees. And Hershey claims, oh, you know, we want our folks to treat their employees like we treat ours. In fact, the guy Kirk Saville, the spokesperson for Hershey, said Hershey cares deeply about all of its employees and those of its vendors. We were disappointed to learn that some of the students were dissatisfied in the cultural immersion element of the program. We were just so disappointed. Yet from the emails that I've gotten from people, from the phone calls that I've gotten, this has been going on for years. And it hasn't been the students, it's been minorities before that, it's been one federal program after another that this Excel and their temp agency and whoever else they've brought in have exploited. Now, anybody who knows anything about these temp agencies know, like I said from the beginning, when you have this service-based economy, it's always the guy at the top who's making out. So I'll bet you, I'll bet my bottom dollar that Hershey is probably paying close to union wage at the end of all this, because they're paying Excel to provide them with a service, and Excel is paying the staffing service to bring employees in, and the staffing service is paying this company to bring those kids here to work for $8 an hour. And all along that chain, every one of those people have to take their little piece. They have to get their profits. They have to take their cut, or it wouldn't work. And in the end, who gets screwed in this whole situation? And this is a much larger problem. It's not just about these hundreds of J-1 students. It's about all workers in this country. You know, temp agencies are the biggest employers. So that means the temp agency's taking a portion of those wages for themselves. Why? Well, because companies don't want to pay unemployment. They don't want to pay workers' comp. They don't want to deal with any of that problem. They want to use you, the worker, as the tool that they see you. When they're done with you, they discard you. And this thing with Hershey's just got me nuts, because what's happened is they're pushing all of this in the wrong direction. This is about the broken labor laws we have in this country. This is about the ability of these big corporations, and Hershey's just the latest one on the skittle. Look, there are thousands of other companies in this country who I under the same microscope would be accused of the exact same thing. And it's just right now that somebody noticed, that someone stood up and someone said no more. Because according to the article, there are almost 700 foreign students here in the area that work at 22 different companies. So it's not just Hershey, and it may sound like, oh, you're beating up on poor Hershey. No, they're the latest one. They're the one who got caught, and they're the one that you're going to focus on. And really, they were stupid about this from the very beginning. They should have come right out the day it happened and said, we're going to take care of this. We're going to make this right. This is not going to happen again. Should have done it day one instead of deflecting and denying and pointing fingers. But that's PR 101. Whoever decided we're going to block this should be fired tomorrow. Or should have been fired yesterday. But at the end of this, what's going to happen here is somebody, the staffing service will take a little heat, and they'll find someone else to bring in and exploit. And those $8 an hour jobs will probably go to some local folks, which that should be what it is. But there's still going to be $8 an hour jobs. They're going to still be jobs with no benefits. That's the bigger thing in this to me. I mean, there is the part of that these kids got screwed. Absolutely. And if my children, when they go and do this, when they get older to go to other countries to experience life in another country, if this were to happen to them, I would be hopping, flipping mad. Because that's not the reason I would send them there. I want them to experience the culture, not to become slaves working in a warehouse. You know, there's part of me that believes they shouldn't be working here at all. They should be immersed in the culture. And it should be as it was when my wife went, where you were part of a family exchange. But that's a whole other argument for a whole other day. And the other part of this is, you look at this whole program, which is supposed to be a government-run program. This is privatization run amok. Once again, We have allowed something that we the people did to be in the hands of the profiteers. And these guys are making huge profits off of this. Just in this area alone, you're talking almost 700 students that paid between $3,000 and $6,000 to come be part of this program. Just here, you're talking hundreds of thousands across the country. Hundreds of thousands. Now, you talk about 300,000 jobs tomorrow that need to be filled. That could help, lower the unemployment rate a little bit. So I got an email today. And this is why this whole thing really caught my attention. The headline of this article read, it was an op-ed. We don't need their type here. And I'm looking at this and I'm going, how absolutely ignorant can the person who wrote this op-ed be? How absolutely out of touch, misinformed, or just plain ignorant can this person be? And he said, well, I read where the foreign students who were protesting in Hershey refused an offer for a free cultural bus tour. This leads me to one conclusion, he writes. They were never interested in cultural exchange to begin with. Yeah, they were interested in tearing the country apart, right? And that's what he says. They're only interested in inciting unrest, as in their counterparts in Europe are doing. Problem is, most of these kids were from Asia. Most of these kids were from China. But let's not let the facts get in the way. He goes on to say, instead of investigating Hershey, and instead of investigating all of the other companies, we should be investigating the groups these students align themselves with. Yeah, go after them. The Marxist, socialist, communist front groups, he says. And I'm sitting here, I'm going, really? This is somebody in our country who went through the American education system? Socialist, communist, Marxist. Sounds like Glenn Beck. And then you get to the next paragraph. And he says, this is part of the top-down, bottom-up, inside-out tactic, admitted communist and Obama advisor Van Jones talked about. And I go, well, there you go. Glenn Beck would be so proud. And he goes into this whole bizarre rant on how, these kids fighting for their rights, fighting, because they got screwed, how they're going to fundamentally transform this country into a socialist state. And I kept sitting here going, I'm missing this guy's point. And then he goes into the students who wanted to experience the American culture. I say you are experiencing the American culture. Students in America don't get a free ride. They borrow money, go to school, work minimum wage jobs while in school, and when they graduate, if they are good enough and employable enough, they get good jobs and pay the money back. He goes into this whole right-wing screed about how our culture is built on hard work, starting from the bottom and working your way up. And I'm going, really? Interesting. He says, if you don't like it, quit and go home to your bankrupt socialist countries. And I'm going, well, actually, China is a communist country, and they're doing quite well. They're taking all of our jobs. they're doing a pretty good job of stealing our manufacturing. But he goes in and he finishes up, with the Glenn Beck punch. We don't want you or your Marxist ideology. You are a poison upon the world and a cancer that needs to be exorcised. And I go, really? So I went back and I looked at this guy. And, of course, long track record of being way out on the fringe. Just an angry, misinformed, unintelligent, basically ignorant man. Who doesn't see the real point here is that workers are being exploited. To me, it doesn't matter that they're from China or the Ukraine or Moldova or who knows where. It matters that people are being cheated. That's what matters. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, right back after this. We're in the fight to bring the middle class back.
The Rick Smith Show.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees are playing an important role in the dedication of the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial in Washington. AFSCME Secretary Treasurer Lee Saunders says Dr. King was defending collective bargaining rights for AFSCME workers when he was killed.
We raised over $1 million to support the construction of the memorial site. He will be the first African American honored in this way by having a monument on the mall. We are urging everybody to attend the festivities and to attend the dedication ceremonies, and more importantly, to rekindle the dream that Dr. King had.
Saunders says had he lived, Dr. King would have been marching alongside today's public workers.
And I think that he would have been in the front of those marches and in the front of those rallies that we had in Wisconsin and that we've had in Ohio and across the country, supporting the right to collective bargaining for public sector workers.
Warehouse Workers United's Shaharier Cauchy says that after exposing health and safety violations, warehouse workers in Chino, California have suffered retaliation from the employer. They're rallying today in Chino to protest that retaliation. The workers reported NFI Industries to California OSHA. After blowing the whistle, workers reported intimidation tactics, including threats to report immigration status, threats of job loss, and assignment changes. Cauchy says that reporting the health and safety violations, though, has also resulted in some improved working conditions at the warehouses that move goods for major American retailers.
The company started pressuring workers less in terms of speed, in terms of the forklifts going fast, workers being told to work faster. They've been trained and told that they have the right to take breaks when it's really hot. They've been told that they have the right to drink water.
Demands for jobs are breaking out at congressional town halls across the country and even in districts where members aren't holding town halls. Jesse Russell reports.
Some representatives are skipping town halls altogether, such as Wisconsin's Representative Paul Ryan. 4 days in a row, seven unemployed constituents have shown up at Ryan's office in Kenosha when it opens and have waited for Ryan to show up. As of this morning, he still hasn't responded to requests for a meeting. Instead, Ryan is hosting a town hall at the local Rotary and asking for a payment of $15 to attend. Scott Page has been outsourced from two separate jobs over the last 3 years.
What a better way to get the unemployed population out of your hair so you could talk your agenda or whatever you're going to do. You know, you charged for the people to get in. I don't have $15 to ask Representative Ryan a question, so, I mean, this is the only means I have to talk to him.
Page says he'll stop showing up at Ryan's office as soon as the representative grants him a meeting. Some representatives are even trying to clamp down on potentially embarrassing videos of constituents challenging them for their job policies. Ohio Republican Representative Steve Chabot banned video cameras from his town halls. In one incident, security was recorded confiscating a cell phone from a senior citizen and moving on to take video cameras from other constituents.
This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We're fighting the battles of the 1920s and the 1930s, and when we brought up things like the weekend or child labor laws, it's because things like right to work should be about as old a debate as they are.
Ever check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Today, back in 1877, the manufacturer of the historic famed Gatling gun wrote to the CEO and president of the B&O Railroad, a guy named John Garrett, during a strike and said, you know what? I've got this thing. I've got this gun. And, you know, because there were some disturbances around the country. He says, you know, if you purchase our product, you know, with the recent riotous disturbances around the country, 4 or 5 men, that's all that's required to operate one of my guns. You can clear a street or a block and keep it clear. That was how they did it back in the 1877. That's how they wanted to take care of people getting out in the streets. That's how they wanted to take care of workers back then. Times have changed. And you look at this thing in Hershey, you know, can you imagine that mentality? When those 400 kids came out of that building? Amazing stuff. I've got our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, on the phone. Irwin, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, good to be here, Rick. How you doing?
I am fantastic. You know, I'm looking at this Hershey thing, and these kids, you got to give them nothing but credit for the courage that they showed and the conviction that they held.
Well, and, you know, it's an amazing thing. Kids come from other countries that we keep assailing as being in the dark ages, backwards, shabbily treating their people, and here we are. Those kids somehow knew how to stand up for what was right here in the United States and knew how to speak out about fundamental issues of justice and fairness and equity and betrayal. And they were betrayed, and they weren't afraid to speak out. It's really kind of wonderful, and I applaud their convictions, and I'm glad we've had no more convictions for the last week.
Right. But, you know, here's the thing. You know, I've been reading some of the negative responses, and especially one guy's locally who, you know, we don't need no foreigners around here, completely missing the point, completely missing the issue. And there's part of me that goes, is our education system that badly broken that, that this guy can't grasp the main concept?
Well, I don't think that it's our education system that's broken. It's our value system that's broken. And that's really much more disconcerting. When, as we have learned over so many decades, a lie is repeated often enough, it becomes the truth. And corporate America has been telling a lie, even though it is corporate America that has been first in line to exploit undocumented workers, illegal immigrants to the United States, and to use them as a wedge to drive down working conditions, to drive down wages, to make people uncertain about their capacity to hold on to their jobs. And so when the poison is fed to the populace so consistently for and so repetitively for such a long time, sometimes it seeps in. The scariest thing about it is that this is, of course, the United States. We are all either immigrants or the sons and daughters of immigrants. Let's get real here. The people who say we don't need none of those foreigners were people who got here because their parents or grandparents were foreigners.
Yep. But here's the thing, Irwin. I mean, you know, in this situation, these kids were guests of ours. And this is how we treat guests into our country.
Well, you know, it is exactly how we treat guests, and we treat our own even worse. One of the shocking things about this situation that I've been mulling over for the last week, since I had the very special privilege of being the guy who got Rick Bloomingdale, Neil Bisnow, and Kathy Jellison released from jail, is why the news media, not the Rick Smith Show, but the very commercialized news media, has so happily, from my perspective, not joyously happy, but happily in the sense of justice, focused on these 400 kids, but completely misses it and ignores it when it comes to tens of thousands of employees of Bank of America being laid off, when it comes to tens and tens of thousands of Verizon workers being told that are supposed to give up 40 years of progress, four decades of progress in one collective bargaining agreement, when we shut down entire industries in this country, and we don't hear so much as a whimper from the Patriot News or the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. And speaking of the Wall Street Journal, every time places like Bank of America lay off big numbers of people, their stock goes up.
Yep,
doesn't go down.
And they applaud it.
They applaud it, and they give the CEO a bonus.
Yep. Well, you know, here's the other part of this. You know, when I was a kid, I used to deliver the Cleveland Plain Dealer in the morning and the Cleveland Press in the evening. And the Cleveland Press actually had a labor page where they followed worker issues. I mean, it's just like the business page in every newspaper in this country. There was a matching labor page where it talked about, you know, what's going on with the different unions, with the different worker groups. And they actually had beat reporters who followed this stuff. I don't know that there are more than three or four labor reporters left in this country.
Oh, you're absolutely right. It's an observation that I've made many, many times. Even small-town papers, relatively small-town papers like the Harrisburg Patriot, when I first came to Harrisburg 39 years ago, had a labor reporter. The New York Times had an entire labor staff you know, a well-known team of labor reporters who I had the honor of being interviewed by and interacting with great regularity. No less than the Wall Street Journal had every Tuesday a labor column on the front page of the journal with squibs about what was going on labor and workplace issues that has now been cut out. And apparently business has been subsumed. Labor has been subsumed by business, and labor is merely a part of business, a commodity, if you will, to be bought and sold, just like so many widgets on the assembly line of life.
Yep. And, you know, I look at these kids, and, you know, the reality in this and in this program, which to me, this J-1 program is really another sign of privatization run amok. But beyond that is another example of how our companies look at workers, just tools to be used and discarded, and then they bring in the next set of tools to be used and discarded.
Oh, in this instance, the Hershey Company has made this into a true science. In the summertime, they bring over J-1 visa guest workers from Europe and Eastern Europe and Asia. And then in the wintertime, they bring in guest workers from South and Central America and Africa to do the same kind of work because, of course, when it's winter here, it's summer there.
Yep.
In the Southern Hemisphere. And if you peel the onion just a little bit, you find that they were housing these kids, three and four to an apartment, no more than two of whom came from the same place, spoke the same language. They were sending them all over the place to Hummelstown and to Palmyra and Middletown and even into Harrisburg, foreign places that they had to be bused to and from, and after deducting from their pay the exorbitant, usurious rents that they were charging and fees for shuttling them back and forth on the bus for the convenience of the company. They had nothing in their pockets, dropped in a foreign place, no host families, no interaction, no nothing. And somehow or another, the expectation was that they would leave here, go home, and tell the story about how wonderful America was. It is really amazing. And add to that commitment that Hershey had, the extraordinary commitment that Hershey had to trying to protect its image as the sweetest place on earth. So after they build this million square foot distribution facility, they turn it over to another company that they run, obviously, who in turn rents workers from yet another company that in turn secures foreign labor from yet a fourth company, so that Hershey would have what? Plausible deniability.
Absolutely. But, you know, here's the thing. When we first started talking about this, I started getting emails from people who have lived there their entire lives and saying, look, you know, before it was the J-1 visa people, it was the work welfare to work people that they were exploiting back there, doing almost the exact same thing, bringing them in on buses, charging for that. And as soon as the money went away from the federal government, so did they. They went on to find somebody else. In fact, you know, we started getting a bunch of emails from people saying, well, this place, and here we find out that there's some 700 of these J-1 visa students in this area at 22 different locations.
Well, the whole thing is breathtaking. It's almost as if these corporations or maybe their trade associations have a cynical group that is charged with the responsibility of coming up with the next program by which to exploit people and contemporaneously cheat us out of our jobs.
Absolutely, but here's the thing. You know, it's not just the J-1 people. It's just not these kids that they're doing this to. I've talked to immigration people for some time. There are folks in Mexico and Guatemala and all of the places where folks come here in an undocumented status. And they all tell the same story. We knew where to go. We knew where the job was. And in most cases, we paid for that information.
Well, but that's my point. This is going on every day, and it's going on not merely with J-1 people, not merely with undocumented, but with the wholesale theft of family-sustaining jobs with family-supportive benefits from our people who are systemically now unemployed and turning those jobs over to people who are here for other purposes, wholly legitimate, or people who are running away from unspeakable conditions in their own country.
Yeah, what's amazing to me is you got these kids who they came from, some of them come from places where you have these petty dictators who, you know, in the case of Bloomingdale and Bisno and Kathy Jellison, those people could have been disappeared or thrown out of planes or shot in the head. And they come here and they have to deal with petty dictators from these CEO boardrooms. Let me ask you a last question. You know, I saw this ad that the Romney campaign came out with in New Hampshire for right to work. They want to make New Hampshire and really the country a right to work country, which, you know, again, the language, it's not right to work. It's right to get screwed. But I look at these kids and I look at these jobs and all of across the country where this stuff we know is going on. I believe that this right to work stuff that we're talking about here in Pennsylvania will only exacerbate the problem and make things that much worse and almost undetectable, in my opinion.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. What's most shocking to me about it is, I mean, let's look at Romney's history, for example. Romney's father, former governor of the state of Michigan and chief executive of the old American Motors Company, was an extraordinary advocate of unionization in the automobile industry and in the related industries, tire and rubber, electronics, textiles that were used to make headliners and the floor mats in automobiles. And here we are, out of rank political opportunism, we have a guy who characterizes himself as a conservative. In his conservative words, is suggesting, in of all places, New Hampshire, and his disciples here in Pennsylvania suggesting the same thing. The government that they keep telling us ought to be smaller should adopt a law that says the government is going to interfere with the free right of workers and their employers to negotiate the terms of a collective bargaining agreement. It is breathtaking that these people who are supposed to be such libertarians, who complain that government is too big, come out of the box, and the one thing they have to do is not to create a job, not to make life a little sweeter for a senior citizen, not to make getting college a little easier for a teenager who's done well in high school, not to make things a little better in the way we get to live, work, and interact with our world, but instead to find a method by which to insert the government in a fashion that is aimed at cutting wages and diminishing the quality of working conditions at the American workplace, at the Pennsylvania workplace, at the New Hampshire workplace, all in the name of what? Recognizing that the Citizens United case imposed upon us by the Supreme Court of the United States allows the corporate raiders to make unfettered contributions, and that's how they're going to raise money.
Yep. And this whole thing by Romney is nothing but a stunt to get him to be more electable for the radical right, simply in the primary. To me, that's what it was. It was nothing but desperation on his part to say, "Hey, I'm as crazy as the other gang with Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs."
Yeah, I'm as crazy as Rick Perry and the other dwarfs.
Yep.
Yeah, let's do it. It's wonderful. It's marvelous. It's America. A friend of mine a couple of months ago talked about this in the context of the effort to repeal the 20th century, and I think that she had it exactly right. And that's what we're about. And people like me who have dedicated a career to advancing from the place where I found myself when I got started a number of years ago are very frustrated. And we need to make sure that this regression is halted in its tracks and that we turn the corner once again and start to make progress and hold these people accountable. But I think that we particularly have to hold them accountable to the ideas that Dels articulate. When they tell us about smaller government, when they tell us that they want to get the government off our backs, when they tell us that there's too much regulation, we need to ask the question of why they would want to pass this phony concept of right to wreck and impose yet another regulation on the process of free negotiation of contracts. I can't imagine it, and I can't imagine the media failing to call them on it.
Well, the media is bought and paid for. And as I've been saying, they want to take us back to the 90s, the
1890s. Yeah,
exactly.
I think you're quite right.
Irwin, always great to talk with you. Always great having you on the program. Look forward to talking to you again next week.
Great to be here, and I look forward to next week. And I'm sorry I missed everybody last week, but we had a more important guest when Rick Bloomingdale
When you sprung him from the big house.
I sprung him from the big house. I got him out of the pokey, and I turned him over to my time on the Rick Smith Show.
Thanks so much, Irwin.
Thank you.
Irwin Aronson, our good friend. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
We have a problem. We need to solve it. This comment by House Speaker Shap Smith of Vermont reflects a no-nonsense, hands-on, can-do attitude you don't often find in legislatures these days. Instead, when most so-called leaders are confronted with a problem, they tend to say, we need to cover it up, or we need to turn it into a political football. But Smith and a big majority of his Vermont colleagues refuse to play games with one of the biggest issues confronting them and the people of every state, affordable health care for all. They knew that the current high-cost, low-quality, you're-on-your-own system was literally killing people, even as it was draining the budgets of governments and businesses. Costs of health care in Vermont have doubled in the last decade to roughly $5 billion a year and continue to go up by $1 million a day, even as 47,000 Vermonters have no coverage and most others have only DGS health insurance. Don't get sick. Angry about this, a strong grassroots campaign for universal health care has been steadily building across Vermont, culminating this year in H-202. This bill would establish a state health exchange authorized to set up a single-payer-style health care system dubbed Green Mountain Care. The bill faced the usual opposition from special interests and know-nothings. One House Republican decried the very idea of universal coverage as, quote, the keystone in the arch of socialism. But with stout public support, Green Mountain Care passed the House 92-49 and the Senate 21-9. On May 26th, Governor Pete Shumlin, who had made this issue central in his campaign last year, signed the bill, making Vermont first in the nation to go to the core of reform by enacting a single-payer law. This is Jim Hightower saying, for information, go to VermontForSinglePayer.com.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Don't really care about the economy. Don't care much about democracy. I'm a member of the GOP, trying to form a plutocracy. But if I can just bamboozle you, and you'll share my narrow point of view, what a wonderful world this would be.
Oh, wouldn't it be wonderful if we just lived in conservative world? Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could just privatize everything? We could give out whips to all the employers. Crack the whip. That'll get productivity up. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we didn't have any laws, if we didn't have any, you know, we just didn't have any of that stuff. You know, when the robber barons of this generation could do whatever they wanted, they could be the job craters. And isn't that what they tell us? Michelle Bachmann herself, you know, if we could do away with that minimum wage, that pesky minimum wage, we could just do away with that. We could employ thousands of people. Oh, it would be great. It would just be so good. And you're looking at Ohio. Congressman Tim Ryan and a number of folks, a number of Republicans as well, held a meeting with a couple of with one of the local unions, Teamsters Local 436 out there. And they're saying, look, this plan that Governor Kasich in Ohio has to hock off the toll roads, they're going to get rid of the Ohio Turnpike, which, mind you, is the highest rated toll road in the entire country. Anybody who's ever driven on the Ohio Turnpike knows that is a perfect road. I don't know that you could find a pothole on that road. It is a perfectly smooth, beautiful ride straight across. We did it when we went to Wisconsin. It was fantastic. Why? Oh, yeah. The money that they get from the tolls takes care of the road. And they even kick some money back. Just like here in Pennsylvania, some of the money goes to take care of the roads because we need it. So what do you got? You got Kasich, who has, like Perry down in Texas, this idea that, oh, I got a great idea. We can balance the budget by selling off all of these assets. Just like here in Pennsylvania, you, with the state wine and spirit shops, you got these Lulus over here going, let's sell off what belongs to the state. Let's put everything on the auction block. That's the Republican plan. And some of the more sane Republicans, like this guy, this Gary Sedolnik, who used to be the executive director of the Ohio Turnpike, just happens to be a Republican as well. He's against the privatization of the Turnpike, saying, look, you know, with technology changes, with things going on, you're talking about signing a deal for 50, 75 years. Have we not learned from what happened to the Indiana Turnpike? Have we not learned the Skyway in Chicago? Have we not learned from all of these privatization schemes that the first thing that happens is the tolls skyrocket and the roads begin to deteriorate? You know, if we sell our turnpike, I ask the question, what's it going to look like when we get it back? Because understand, whoever takes it, they're going to want their money back with interest and lots of it so they can fill their pockets. It wouldn't be a good business deal if they couldn't. But we don't seem to think like that anymore. We seem to think very short-term what's right in front of our nose instead of going, hey, maybe down the road we should be thinking of something else. So Tom Corbett today, I guess, was out on the Susquehanna River as part of his two-day excursion, partially to promote tourism. He wants to draw a little attention to the state waterways, you know, the parks, our natural resource, and how beautiful Pennsylvania is. And that's a good thing. There's part of me that thinks, again, with this conservative world mentality, that maybe it's a sales tour. Maybe he's got some people saying, hey, we got a nice river here. It's good for kayaking. We can sell it to you and make sure that every person who puts a boat in the water has to pay you. Because that's what it's coming to. You know, my wife and I went to look at it back when I lived up north. Well, I lived in Allentown, worked up north of Allentown. We wanted to buy a piece of property up near Tannersville. And the property was split across the main road, across Route 715 there. And you had 26 acres on one side, I think like 10 on the other. But there was a stream that ran through one part of it. And you had to build a bridge over it. You couldn't put any pylons or anything in the water. Nothing could touch the water. And why is that? Well, because the one private interest up there owned that water. About 100 years ago, they privatized that water. You can't even put your feet in the water without fear of being fined because they actually own the water. And I keep asking, when is that going to happen everywhere? When will we end up back in the 1880s, 1890s, where everything is for sale, everything is for profit, and nothing belongs to us? The water now belongs to somebody. You know, when will the air belong to somebody? I guess when they figure out how to can it and make sure you can't get a hold of it. But at the end of this, what scares me is that we're slowly buying into this. And I think it's, well, we just don't want to pay taxes. So if we can sell off this asset, you know, we won't have to worry about it. It'll be taken care of. I'm telling you, that's not how it works. Once we privatize the state stores, that resource, that asset, that's gone. We've sold an asset. We've sold our furniture. We've sold whatever. You sold something out of your house, it's gone. You're never going to get it again. Once we sell our turnpike, not going to get that back again. And when you do, 99 years down the road, I think was the agreement, they have a 99-year lease. What condition do you get it back in? And that's kind of the worry here. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Curious your thoughts on this. You know, in going with the conservative world theme, there's a guy who's running for Wiener's spot, a guy named Bob Turner, a Republican. Evidently, he told the Daily News editorial board there in New York that, and you got to love this, that the $4.3 billion Agrota 9/11 health care law was just too broad. And his thought was it shouldn't cover the volunteers. It should only cover the paid people. You know, the people, you know, the cops and the construction people who are actually being paid. None of those volunteers. And as anybody, you know, who knew what was going on down there, it was a very open. You signed in. They have records of who was where and when. There were no uniforms. There were no, hey, where's your anything? Volunteers worked right next to rescue crews. There were volunteers from around the country who came. And for this guy to come out and say, well, we don't want to have to cover those people, only the people that would be covered by workman's comp. It was kind of his argument. Because we need to save the city that money, but we don't want to deal with those volunteers. Screw them. And it's that kind of mentality that kind of makes me, again, afraid of conservative world. Because if this is what we're doing to people that they held up, and understand, the Republicans and the Democrats held these folks up on the highest of pedestals. And they deserved it. They deserved all the accolades and all the credit. Those people who rushed into buildings, those people who rushed to the pile to help folks, we have to respect them and we have to honor them. But more importantly, we have to take care of them. Because these people are now becoming sick. They have lung problems. And they're dying. And what does it say about us if we don't take care of them? What does it say to the next generation of people if something happens, those people that we're gonna look to as the next hero? What's it going to say to them when they look back and go, whoa, whoa, whoa. I saw how you treated the last people you called a hero. No thanks. That's troublesome. And it's amazing that there's a conservative Republican, one of these T-twits, running for Wiener spot out there in New York who just thinks, well, you know what? Ah, heck with those volunteers. Heck with them. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this with your calls.
To the Rick Smith Show.
My name is Precious, and I help people with mental illnesses live better lives. I work for you, the taxpayers, as a mental health case manager. People with mental illnesses can hold jobs, pay taxes, and provide for themselves. But many of them need help from social workers like me to reach their full potential. Imagine if you or someone you love needed that kind of help and had to go on a waiting list for 7 years. That's what 10 years of budget cuts have already done to mental health caseloads in our state. I know these are tough economic times, but without support services, some individuals get worse and can be a danger to themselves and their communities. And that costs all of us much more in the long run. Please contact your state legislators today and demand that they vote to increase funding for programs that help people with mental illnesses lead full lives.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our human services campaign.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events. Accidents, critical illness, disability, or death? No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Now we all ought to feel just a little bit guilty when we look into the eyes of our kids. Cause brothers, it's a fact, if we take and don't put back, they'll have to pay for all we did. So let's leave some blue up above us. Let's leave some green on the ground. It's only as tomorrow, let's say some for tomorrow. Leave it and pass it on down.
Yes, sir. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520 7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of our program, you can download the Stitcher app if you got one of the smartphones. Take your class war to go, or you can go to thericksmithshow.com. Everything's right there for your convenience. It appears that the Chinese are even stealing our bad TV ideas. It's not bad enough that they're, you know, they're taking all of our patents and not matter, you know, no licensing requirements, no patent problems. They'll take it all. But there's a program in Hong Kong. It's called the Battle of the Poor Rich. And it's their big smash TV hit there, because it turns the city's wealthiest business titans into the city's poorest laborers. Only for a couple of days. And it kind of reminded me of that stupid show that I think CBS had, that Undercover Boss, who I was following for a while, and then it just got boring. I mean, it was the same thing over and over and over with just different people. The CEO, who's the big dictator, I'm going to go and I'm going to show these people how to do things. And then they get out into the field, and they're completely inept. They can't even put a biscuit in a bag. They're pathetic. And, you know, there's part of me that goes, nobody can be that inept. They've got to be doing this on purpose. And then at the end, they give away a big prize. You know, here's a vacation. Hey, you get a vacation. That's your prize. And here in this country, much like Hershey, saying, oh, we're going to give you a sweet deal. You're going to get a vacation. Where in other industrialized nations, vacation is part of the package. You get 20, 30 days a year. Here in the U.S., no. Sorry, no vacation for you. You work till you die. Anyway, the program in Hong Kong, the Battle of the Poor Rich, big there. And you look at Hong Kong, third highest share of households worth $100 million or more on earth. Third highest. One of the big business CEOs was on the program, and he could not bear sleeping in these little cage homes they have. Because they got these little, they look like dog kennels. Barely enough, you know, for people to stand in. And you basically end up sleeping. Well, he couldn't do it. So he ended up actually sleeping in the street. He also had trouble with his $6 a day garbage collection job. And he nearly passed out, they say, from the stench. Again, you know, this is something that these poor people have to put up with. And, you know, he was out there, and again, basically just completely inept to do it and didn't have the skills to exist in that world. But, you know, he was out there giving it his all. The producer of the program, Doris Wong, said, hopefully we are changing the mindset of one rich person at a time. And I'm going, no, you're not. Has it changed at these companies? Are you seeing them pay higher wages? No. It's propaganda. It's to get you to think, oh, gee, they care. My boss cares about me. Not likely. And it's that theme. Well, you know, the benevolent dictator. You know, they care. And they, you know, they tried, and they're going to make things better. It hasn't happened. But it's all about the messaging, and they're masters at that. You look at the other thing that the conservative world has brought us. It's this attack on public sector workers. And again, it's all about attacking working conditions. You know, I remember watching The Undercover Boss, one of the very first ones. And it was the guy from, I think it was Waste Management, who was really pathetic. He couldn't even pick up plastic bags with a stick. And asking for directions. I mean, it was really corny and it was really, really bad. But I do think there was a moment where even he was stunned. There was a woman who was driving the garbage truck, and you may remember me talking about this in the past. And, you know, she's driving a garbage truck in a residential neighborhood. And she pulls out this coffee can and she goes, there's my bathroom. And he's like, really? Oh, I didn't realize. Well, where did you think this woman was going to park this truck and go to the bathroom? Do you think one of those people living in those houses are going to let some stinky garbage person into their house to use the bathroom? No. But I just remember the look of, I mean, he really played it very well, this look of shock. But it's this whole attack on workers, this whole attack on conditions. And the theme that we keep hearing is that, well, you know, these public sector workers, they make too much money. And we need to steal collective bargaining away from them. And Bloomberg News did an interesting op-ed piece, because evidently they have an editorial board, their view, And they're saying, look, you know, the reality is when you sit down like Connecticut and New York did and you actually negotiate, you get somewhere. You don't have to steal from these people. You negotiate. You sit at a bargaining table and you do the hard work. And it works. Because everybody understands when times are tough, you know, we got to punch in a little bit and they're willing. But when times are good, we'd like to share a little bit more. And I thought it was interesting that Bloomberg News, who I don't see as some hippie liberal pro-labor group, coming out saying, look, we don't need to be stealing collective bargaining rights away. Don't need to be doing it. Look how much money it's cost. It hasn't saved the states or the cities anything. Look at Ohio and Wisconsin. How much money are they going to spend on recall elections? When they could have sat down at the table and said, look, this is the reality. This is what we have to work with. Because, you know, people are going to fight back, you know? Also, the Keystone Research Center, they did an analysis of public and private sector workers, and they came out with something pretty amazing. That Pennsylvania public sector employees, statistically, they have a 2.1% lower wage than people in the private sector. And people go, no, that's not true. Well, it is when you factor in education. The reality is in the public sector, 53% of the full-time workers in Pennsylvania's public sector have four-year college degrees, compared to only 32% in the private sector. So people who are educated, who have these advanced degrees, they end up working for the state. They end up saying, you know, there are things, technical things that we can do. That's where they end up. You look at the reality that, you know, in Pennsylvania state and local governments and the school districts, they pay college-educated workers 21% less than the people in the private industry do. Now think about that for a second, because it's important when you start talking about school districts, because there's this whole push to privatizing Pennsylvania's education. Understand how this whole thing works. When you gauge for educational attainment, when you gauge for people who have advanced degrees, in the private sector, they make considerably more than they do in the public sector. So when we privatize education, when we profitize education, when we start corporatizing, what's going to happen is the wages of those people are going to have to go up. And what does that mean for you, the taxpayer? The same person you were paying to do the job as a public servant, you're now paying as a profiteer, your taxes are going to go up. Because not only are you paying higher wages there, you're probably also going to pay a big sum of that to the company itself, to the CEO of these. And we're seeing this with the for-profit universities. The only problem is the professors there have not figured out how to monetize it yet because they haven't organized. They're still allowing themselves to be used as adjuncts, and they're still allowing themselves to be used, you know, doing online classes on the side. At some point, that does catch up. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Don Siegel. He's the vice president of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the 3rd District, covering Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and in the surrounding area. We're going to talk about this piece on free trade that he had published in the Post-Gazette. We're right back after this.
Don't know much about the French I took, but I do know that I need you. And if you fall for all the crap I spew, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees are playing an important role in the dedication of the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial in Washington. AFSCME Secretary Treasurer Lee Saunders says Dr. King was defending collective bargaining rights for AFSCME workers when he was killed.
We raised over $1 million to support the construction of the memorial site. He will be the first African American honored in this way by having a monument on the mall. We are urging everybody to attend the festivities and to attend the dedication ceremony. ceremonies, and more importantly, to rekindle the dream that Dr. King had.
Saunders says had he lived, Dr. King would have been marching alongside today's public workers.
And I think that he would have been in the front of those marches and in the front of those rallies that we had in Wisconsin and that we've had in Ohio and across the country, supporting the right to collective bargaining for public sector workers.
Warehouse Workers United's Shaharier Couchy says that after exposing health and safety violations, warehouse workers in Chino, California have suffered retaliation from the employer. They're rallying today in Chino to protest that retaliation. The workers reported NFI Industries to California OSHA. After blowing the whistle, workers reported intimidation tactics, including threats to report immigration status, threats of job loss, and assignment changes. Couchy says that reporting the health and safety violations, though, has also resulted in some improved working conditions at the warehouses that move goods for major American retailers.
The company started pressuring workers less in terms of speed, in terms of the forklifts going fast, workers being told to work faster. They've been trained and told that they have the right to take breaks when it's really hot. They've been told that they have the right to drink water.
Demands for jobs are breaking out at congressional town halls across the country and even in districts where members aren't holding town halls. Jesse Russell reports.
Some representatives are skipping town halls altogether, such as Wisconsin's Representative Paul Ryan. 4 days in a row, seven unemployed constituents have shown up at Ryan's office in Kenosha when it opens and have waited for Ryan to show up. As of this morning, he still hasn't responded to requests for a meeting. Instead, Ryan is hosting a town hall at the local Rotary and asking for a payment of $15 to attend. Scott Page has been outsourced from two separate jobs over the last 3 years.
What a better way to get the unemployed population out of your hair so you could talk your agenda or whatever you're going to do. You know, you charged for the people to get in. I don't have $15 to ask Representative Ryan a question, so, I mean, this is the only means I have to talk to him.
Page says he'll stop showing up at Ryan's office as soon as the representative grants him a meeting. Some representatives are even trying to clamp down on potentially embarrassing videos of constituents challenging them for their job policies. Ohio Republican Representative Steve Chabot banned video cameras from his town halls. In one incident, security was recorded confiscating a cell phone from a senior citizen and moving on to take video cameras from other constituents.
This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I will oppose the Columbia Free Trade Agreement. I want Congress to pass a set of trade deals. Send a message to Congress to come to an agreement on trade deals.
They're selling make-believe, and we don't buy that here. 'Cause in the real world, they're shutting Detroit down.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Also, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You know, from the start of the whole debt ceiling debate, I've been saying we are just being distracted. We're being led astray. Here, over here, focus on the shiny thing instead of seeing what the real problem is. And the real problem is what we've been talking about on this program for months now. It's about jobs. And not just any jobs, but the jobs that create things. You know, we need sane trade policies that are going to encourage companies to make things here in the U.S. for domestic consumption and for export when it's beneficial. And, you know, when the president was on the campaign trail, I sat no more than 30 feet from him with a friend of mine, Alex from CWA, when he said, you know, he said this.
I will oppose the Columbia Free Trade Agreement if George Bush is insistent on sending it to Congress because the violence against unions in Colombia would make a mockery of the very labor protections that we've insisted be included in these kinds of agreements.
You know, as I'm sitting there, you know, I'm going, yeah, that's what I want to hear. And he goes on to say this.
You can trust me when I say that whenever trade deals we negotiate come to my desk, they are going to be good for American workers, that they'll have powerful labor and environmental protections, and that we will enforce those protections.
You know, here's the thing. You know, the trade deals that he's talking about, the three same ones from the Bush era, don't seem much different to me now than they did then. And here to talk about this with us is and his piece that was published in Monday's Pittsburgh Post-Gazette titled The Korean Trade Deal is Bad for Pennsylvania's Don Siegel. He's a vice president of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, District 3. Don, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick, for giving me the opportunity to speak with you this evening.
You know, I look at your piece, and it's spot on in every regard. The reality is this president, who I voted for and I support, is doing something that he said wasn't going to do.
That's true, and as is the case with this president in the last few years, he's been trying to appease the business interest groups that have been part of his cabinet and part of his campaign. And it's just absolutely destructive to U.S. jobs. The bleeding of jobs in this country is the real core problem in the economy, and that didn't start yesterday. That started 35 years ago when they started to offshore a lot of the steel industry and move a lot of heavy industrial products overseas, or the production of products overseas. And in 1992, we were warned by a candidate then, Ross Perot, that we would hear a giant sucking sound when NAFTA came through. Now, in the 90s, it was kind of camouflaged by the dot-com boom, and I think a lot of people didn't realize just how many manufacturing jobs were being taken out of this country as a result of NAFTA.
Now, and Ross Perot, who, you know, again, people thought was kind of kooky, but he was right.
There will be a giant sucking sound going south.
And what we've seen is we've seen those jobs go, and I look at these trade agreements that the president's talking about, Korea, Colombia, Panama. I don't see these creating jobs, and I think it's the wrong time right now when the economy's where it's at, with the unemployment rate where it's at. I just think it's bad all the way around for you and me. But again, these trade deals aren't about us.
No, they're not. Capital follows cheap labor. And it's all about the Wall Street mentality of getting shareholder value. These corporations anymore today, Rick, they don't fly a flag. Capitalism is not patriotism. I'm a capitalist in a sense, but I'm also a very, very strong trade unionist. We need to have free enterprise and we need to have free markets, but we don't need to have totally unregulated financial markets that go global.
Yeah, I mean, you cannot. I don't care what anybody says, and I've had union people try and explain how we can compete with China. I'm sorry, I don't know how American workers can compete with 50 cents an hour, with exploitable labor conditions, and basically no environmental laws.
But you're right. The environmental laws are another issue altogether, and you know we wouldn't have time this evening to go into the details of that. But there's no question that. That the American worker who lives the American lifestyle, some regard as the American dream, cannot compete with workers that live four or five to a room, stacked up in beds that are right next to a factory, and living in squalor in many of these places, certainly down the maquiladoras in Mexico. And the ironic thing is that NAFTA drove a lot of jobs to Mexico, and now a lot of those jobs have been driven to China.
Yep.
And what has happened is even the Mexicans have a hard time competing with the Chinese.
You know, at the end of this, and you made an excellent point. Why are you going to compete with people stacking four people in a room? And you look at what just happened here in Hershey last week, where Hershey Chocolate, outsourcing to this XL who, you know, did business with another company, all this stuff. They've got four people stacked up in a room, working basically in a sweatshop for $44 a week. Kind of makes you wonder.
And I grew up in Reading, Pennsylvania, Rick, not, less than 50 miles from Hershey, Pennsylvania. I remember going to Hershey as a kid to tour the factory and tour the park. Quite frankly, what has happened in Hershey just recently is something that has even shocked me as a trade unionist who has seen poor working conditions. I think that is a statewide embarrassment to Pennsylvanians, and it's certainly a national embarrassment to have kids that were basically college students or whatever that were basically duped into paying their own money to come over here and work under those conditions under the premise that it would be some kind of cultural exchange.
Yep.
It's absolutely embarrassing to me as a Pennsylvanian and also to me as an American to have that discovered right here in our own backyard.
Yeah, and you look at the numbers, and it's outrageous. And you know, I since this happened, I've been talking about my wife who did these kind of things. She went to Spain, she went to Germany, and I can't imagine how her parents and how our country would have looked at the Germans or the Spanish people who, if they would have put her in a sweatshop like that and treated her like that. I can't imagine from our perspective what we would say about those countries.
Well, I'm pretty positive that there would be a public outcry if this happened to American exchange students that went overseas under the guise of a cultural program and ended up in those kinds of conditions. I'm positive that there would be a national outcry against it.
Yeah, well, this whole thing is, again, another example of privatization run amok. We've given what government used to do to the private sector, and look what they've done with it. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Don Siegel, Vice President of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the 3rd District. He's written a great piece, The Korea Trade Deal is Bad for Pennsylvania. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com if you want to look at it. You know, getting back to this article for a second, you point out something that I don't think most people understand about these trade deals. Basically, we're losing our sovereignty. These laws end up, these trade deals end up taking away our ability to regulate our own environment, regulate working environments, regulate anything, because these corporations, these huge multinationals, can go to these secret tribunals that they've set up and basically override any law that you and I dictate for our country.
That's exactly right, and I don't think that most people really know just how far-reaching those laws can be. It's not only in environmental standards. As an example, it was several years ago under NAFTA that there was a prevailing wage law challenged in New York State because a Mexican company was building a subsidiary up in New York State, and it was an automated plant. And they got state subsidy money from New York to build it. But under NAFTA, they actually filed a charge against enforcement of prevailing wage laws in New York State. Now, that case never came to fruition because they never built the plant. They backed out of the deal. But these tribunals the ability for foreign countries to challenge our laws based on the agreements that we're striking here, such as NAFTA and CAFTA, and now these proposed agreements like the Korean Free Trade Agreement, Panama, and Colombia, they're just so far-reaching, and they leave us so vulnerable to challenges from these countries.
You know, one of the things that that I've been saying for the longest time, you know, this, especially with Colombia, there's this talk in our country about we need to be more business friendly. We need to cater to business a little bit more. And, you know, just off the cuff, I said that, you know, what's more business friendly than taking a trade unionist off of a bus and shooting him in the head or throwing him out of an airplane? And, you know, I got some reaction from folks, but the reality is the people who are running this country, the Koch brothers and the billionaire class who are pulling the strings, I don't know, stealing collective bargaining away, kicking people out into the street, I don't know if there's much difference in my mind.
Well, I mean, certainly the violence is not the same, but you bring up a very valid point. Most of the people that are in control of the financial markets in this country, they only think they know what life is like for the middle class. They have long since lost touch with that. I'd say the same thing so much about Washington. We send people to Washington all the time, and Washington is a 75-mile area that's surrounded by reality. So inside that Washington bubble, they seem to have their own social system, their own communication system, even the media that's based in Washington, the lobbyists that are based in Washington. They're all in touch with each other. They're social friends. They're family friends. They go to cocktail parties together. They only talk to each other most of the year. And then every once in a while, our politicians come back and they have a few town hall meetings. They take care of a couple of passport issues and constituency service, and they think that they're in touch with the middle class.
Yeah. And now we're seeing a lot of these representatives who they want pay-per-view events to, for their constituents to be able to see them. I think of Paul Ryan or the guy Cabot from Ohio, Barlotta up the road here, a bunch of them, they want to be paid to do their job on top of being paid to do their job.
Yeah, they do. And what I don't think they realize, which was, it's just so interesting about town hall meeting, is they want to talk about labor bosses and talk about the power that these so-called labor bosses wield, and I guess I would be categorized as one of them, and I would love to see any of them stand up to a union meeting once a month and be answerable to the constituency that elected them.
Excellent point. I know many of the meetings I've went to, I wouldn't want to be the guy in front. Let me ask you a last question, change topics here a little bit. CWA and IBEW went on strike just about 2 weeks ago against Verizon. Back to work as of Tuesday morning. How are the things going? Any movement? Are we going to see a contract anytime soon?
Well, what we have right now, Rick, is we have a one-week cooling-off period. They only went back to Tuesday, so they're not really discussing anything for this first week. They're going back to the table under a different scenario. What I'd like to certainly clear up and for your audience is that this strike was not so much about the contract itself as it was about bargaining.
Yep.
And what had happened is that Verizon came to the table and they just flat out refused to bargain. They threw all of these issues on the table and they didn't want to bargain. The union, both CWA and the IBEW, presented to them that they would continue to negotiate as they worked under the old contract. Verizon didn't want to do that, and that's what forced this strike. And the strike was really about getting back to the bargaining table. We knew in our heart of hearts that when we went on strike on August 6th, that it was not going to necessarily result in a very good contract. What we were really looking for is what happened. We wanted to get back to the bargaining table and restructure the bargaining, get a commitment from Verizon that they would discuss certain issues at a high level and then regional issues at another level, and we would get down to serious talks and discussions while our people continued to work under the old contract. And that's what's happening now. Now, whether that will result in a contract that's acceptable or not remains to be seen, but I am at this point cautiously optimistic. However, talks will not really begin or resume as far as negotiations are concerned until next week.
But I think the message was well sent. I watched a lot of the videos that members from around the country sent us, and you know, while they were comical, they were scary, because I'm surprised no one got hurt, and I'm thankful that no one got hurt. The supervisors and the people who are out there doing the replacement work. Don Siegel, I appreciate your time. Excellent piece again. The Korea trade deal is bad for Pennsylvania. Over at the Pittsburgh Post Gazette, we've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Don, thanks so much. I appreciate the time. I'd love to have you back again soon.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show.
We have a problem. We need to solve it. This comment by House Speaker Shap Smith of Vermont reflects a no-nonsense, hands-on, can-do attitude you don't often find in legislatures these days. Instead, when most so-called leaders are confronted with a problem, they tend to say, "We need to cover it up," or "We need to turn it into a political football." But Smith and a big majority of his Vermont colleagues refuse to play games with one of the biggest issues confronting them and the people of every state, affordable health care for all. They knew that the current high-cost, low-quality, you're-on-your-own system was literally killing people, even as it was draining the budgets of governments and businesses. Costs of health care in Vermont have doubled in the last decade to roughly $5 billion a year and continue to go up by $1 million a day, even as 47,000 Vermonters have no coverage and most others have only DGS health insurance. don't get sick. Angry about this? A strong grassroots campaign for universal health care has been steadily building across Vermont, culminating this year in H202. This bill would establish a state health exchange authorized to set up a single-payer-style health care system dubbed Green Mountain Care. The bill faced the usual opposition from special interests and know-nothings. One House Republican decried the very idea of universal coverage as, quote, the keystone in the arch of socialism. But with stout public support, Green Mountain Care passed the House 92-49 and the Senate 21-9. On May 26, Governor Pete Shumlin, who had made this issue central in his campaign last year, signed the bill, making Vermont first in the nation to go to the core of reform by enacting a single-payer law. This is Jim Hightower saying, for information, go to VermontForSinglePayer.com.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today.
Well, you know, you think about that. You know, that was from a movie back in the 70s. And, you know, how clairvoyant were they? To be able to look, you know, some 40 years later and go, yeah, we told you. Why didn't you listen? 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Also, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. And if you want to tweet us, it's @ricksmithshow. Dustin sent us a tweet, said, I didn't know about these secret tribunals that can override a nation's trade laws. It's worse than that, Dustin. It's not your trade laws. It's your laws. You know, the big famous case in California is the Charlie Tuna case, where the state of California said, you've got to do things when you're catching the tuna to make sure the dolphins don't get caught up in the nets. And they passed a law, and Mexico, they took them to the secret tribunal. Now, these tribunals, we don't know who's on them. We don't get to know what's being said. We don't get to know anything. It's secret. It's done outside of the country. We know nothing about it. You and I can't go watch. There's none of that. There's no oversight. There's nothing for you and me. And in the Charlie Tuna case, they lost. You know, understand that these trade agreements are about the least restrictive barriers. And that's important because if we decide, like Don Siegel said, to have a prevailing wage, even a minimum wage, that can be challenged. And you may lose. And you may have to go and say, you know what? We have to do away with this. A couple other cases that have popped up over the years, especially environmental stuff. Mexico has tried to sue us in these tribunals to allow them to dump chemicals in the U.S. that we dump there. I mean, it's fair, I guess, if you look at it that way. I would say we shouldn't be dumping anywhere. We should be, you know, figuring out a way to do this stuff with a little bit of consciousness on how it's going to affect the environment. But these trade laws, to me, bad all around. And this one with Korea is huge to me because there's nothing in this that says that the cars that we buy, the products that we buy, aren't going to be made in North Korea or aren't going to be made in China. There's a 35% domestic content rule. I mean, hell, NAFTA has a 50% domestic content rule. When the EU, when they negotiated with Korea, they got a 55% content. We couldn't even get that. And I'm going, well, who do these trade laws benefit? Who do these agreements benefit? They don't benefit you and me. We're the ones who suffer under them. And if the Republicans have their way, we're going to suffer even more because they're not going to put any trade adjustment assistance in this at all. Sorry, you're just going to get unemployment. So no new job training, none of that. You're just out of luck. Your industry's done. Sorry, there's the road. And what I've been saying for the longest time, we need trade deals and we need a whole new a whole new way of thinking about trade. Because it's been pounded in our head that, oh, once we open up those markets, they're going to buy our goods. I'd like some examples on that, please. Can you send those? Rick at therickSmithShow.com, 1-888-520-RICK. I'd love to hear it. And while we're getting some exports out, the Chinese are killing us. I was just reading another story today about the solar panel industry, another company filing bankruptcy. Why? Right in the article. Sorry, can't compete with the cheap Chinese and the subsidized Chinese manufacturers and the currency manipulation. Sorry, cannot compete. So these American companies who are making solar panels, done. And then you got the Republicans saying, well, that's good. That's what we wanted. We don't want alternative energy. We want to drill, baby, drill. So I ask you, are these trade policies any good for us? And I'm saying for me, for every working stiff, for every one of the people who are the 62% of the people who are in the working class, those people who punch a clock and collect a paycheck, these are not good for us. And I voted for this guy, just like I voted for Clinton. But understand, NAFTA was a foregone conclusion. That was done. Started under Reagan, completely negotiated under Bush. In came Clinton, made some slight, very minor, toothless adjustments, you know, trying to appease a couple of people. Didn't really help, but he signed it. And had it been anybody but Clinton or Bush, had it been Perot, maybe we wouldn't have these trade agreements. But Perot, for me, when he started talking about the Black Panthers kidnapping his kids and, you know, out to get him, a little off the deep end. That's when I think he lost a good portion of the country. But again, these trade deals, it seems to be decided rule. It seems to be what's been preached. And I go back quite often to what my economics teacher was preaching, you know, years ago. This whole free market, this whole the wonders of neoliberalism. And I kind of start and think, you know, the Koch brothers, they spent money on colleges to be able to have a say in which professors are standing in front of the classroom. And, gee, I wonder what their philosophy is. Oh, yeah, free markets, open borders, mobile capital. The wonders of the rich. You and I, workers, not just here in the U.S., but across the globe, in China, in India, you name it, at the mercy of these few. Because capital is mobile. That's what these agreements are really about. It's opening up the financial world. It's allowing capital to move around at lightning speed. So one, you can't really track it. So that they don't have to pay taxes and they don't have to be good citizens. They can just be capitalists and they can rush around the globe. And hey, when things get a little hairy, like it did after 9/11 in Argentina, they can just pull all their money out and everything collapses. And you and I suffer. And you know why we suffer? Because they go into these countries, and Libya's next. They go into these countries and they steal any form of a social safety net away, and they privatize everything. So you're at the mercy of the corporate dictator. You're at the mercy of the CEO dictator. That's what they want. That's what they want. And until we get off this, it's the immigrants and it's these people and it's those people and, oh, I hate them and I hate them. Until we get off of that, we're going to continue to be sliced and diced and divided and at each other's throats. We got to realize who we're fighting in this fight. And it's not you and me going after each other. It's not me going after the welfare mother or me going after the person who's homeless or whatever. It's not about that. It's about looking at the Kochs. It's about looking at the investor class who is screwing this country up so badly. The people we think are job creators. It's job creators. Because they keep pushing these agreements that are killing us. And it's destroying our manufacturing base. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Joshua Holland. He's the editor and senior writer over at Alternet, talking about his piece, Make It in America, How We Can Bring Manufacturing Back. No, really. We're right back after this. Stick around.
Monday and shipping it offshore. Do the job and saving work in America. One show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
I'm ready to do what has to be done for the next generation. With the courage to fight for freedom. With the courage to fight for America. That's why I'm announcing today that I'm running for president of the United States.
The frothy one himself declaring his run for presidency. And, you know, I got to be honest with you, Mr. I'm going to make America America again with his jobs plan of, oh, we're just going to cut taxes again. We're going to cut taxes again. We're going to cut taxes. That seems to be the right-wing mantra not working. Fortunately, somebody has got their head on straight. Dennis Kucinich today urging the White House to fire Jeffrey Immelt. The jobs czar. And, you know, this is like I said last night. And you know, the email I got from my right-wing listserv complaining about GE moving its X-ray plant from Waukesha, Wisconsin to Beijing. You know, I think even the right wing gets it. Look, it doesn't take a genius to figure out how to get this economy moving again. Even the teabaggers get it. Now all we have to do is get these politicos in D.C. on the right path. That's why I've asked Joshua Holland, editor and senior writer over at Alternet, to come talk to us about his piece, Make It in America, How We Can Put a Manufacturing Back. No, really, we can. We can bring it back. Josh, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
You know, I look at this situation with the job czar, and I'm going, really, was this the best choice? Mr. Outsourcer himself, is this the guy that's going to create jobs?
I mean, the message that sends to the progressive base and everybody else is pretty crazy. Let's rely on people who have shipped millions and millions of jobs overseas to create jobs here at home.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
it's madness.
And this is what I've been saying. I think there's some universal truths. Manufacturing is one of the things that you have to have. You have to make things if you're going to be a country at all. You have to make, like us, we want to be a war society. We need bombs and we need planes and we need that stuff. But you also need the steel to do it as well.
Well, you know, that's true, but it's the opposite of what we've been told for 30 years now. I mean, the entire globalization agenda, the mantra that we hear again and again is that we don't have to worry about manufacturing because we're so technologically advanced and creative and smart that we'll add tons of value with these service jobs. You know, sounds great. It's a great sounding plan. It's absolute nonsense. According to one analysis, if you look at the average manufacturing job, it pays 15% more than the average service job. And, you know, we've seen so many good jobs. People don't realize, I think, how deeply, deeply decimated our manufacturing base has become. Just in the last 10 years,
yep,
we've shed a third of our manufacturing jobs, just in the last 10 years.
You know, I went home to my hometown in Cleveland, Ohio, and I remember, you know, they on Brook Park that had Chevy on 160th and on 150th, you had the Ford plant. So you had two big manufacturing plants. And all along that road, hundreds of small machine shops and feeder industries that employed 30, 40 people in each one of those things, all that stuff is now gone.
That's right. And, you know, getting back to this kind of fairy tale that we're supposed to just sell each other insurance and sue each other and that's going to be a better economy, I point out in the piece that, you know, manufacturing accounts for about 12% of our economic output right now, but 70% of our research and development investment. Technology and innovation follows manufacturing. It
yep.
doesn't follow, again, insurance sales or selling stocks and bonds. This is an integral part of having a prosperous economy. And when we see manufacturing in this country as a share of output peaked in 1979 at 24%. We've lost half of our manufacturing base since then. Now, what happened between 1979 and now? You and I know this story very well, even if a lot of Americans aren't familiar with it. Wages have been stagnant. If you take the top 10% off of the wage distribution between 73, 74, something like that, and 2006, the rest of us got a pay cut, 6% pay cut when adjusted for inflation. And I would be hesitant to just look at the offshoring of our manufacturing base as the sole cause of that. But I think it's very clear from a lot of the economic data that it's a major one.
Yep.
I mean, we're offshoring a lot of union jobs and we're replacing them with service jobs. And this is the race to the bottom. You know, we've been told for 30 years that all of these things that seem common sense to people, you know, if you're sending good paying manufacturing jobs that were available as a way up to the middle class, right? These used to be ladders into the middle class. If you didn't have a PhD, you could get a good factory job, you could get a good manufacturing job and make a decent life for yourself, send your kids to college. This stagnation correlates very well with the decline in manufacturing. And we're told that these jobs this is all hopeless. What I'm saying is a hopeless dream because we can never have manufacturing again. And it's a myth. It's a myth. The problem is that the steps that you would need to take to return a real manufacturing base to the United States are unpopular with corporate America. It's really very simple. Look at the difference in how much wealth the investing class versus the working class is taking in right now. Starting in, I believe, 2006, but maybe 2005, working people have taken the lowest share of our national income, and investors have taken the highest share. And if you send good-paying jobs overseas to create things that you're going to then re-import into the United States to sell in this market, it seems extraordinarily obvious that you would end up with that effect. But, you know, we have this kind of fantasy. They call it free trade. Look at the media, how willing they are to kind of advance the idea that this is about freedom. You know what free trade deals, these trade deals are? It's about a company like General Motors going to the government and saying, look, this is what we need in order to have a smooth operation of building things abroad to sell to this market.
Yep.
And whatever that may be, that's what's negotiated away.
And that's what these trade deals are about. You know, you look at this, it's a massive, as you've pointed out, a massive redistribution of wealth. And when I talk to these T-twits who say, well, you're talking about redistribution of wealth, I go, damn right I am. I want what my grandparents fought for.
Yes. I mean, you know, redistribution of wealth, it only seems to bother conservatives when it's downward. We've had a massive redistribution of wealth over the last 30 years upward.
But I thought it was supposed to come trickling down on us like rivers of gold and honey, and it was supposed to be wonderful. If we just gave them enough, if we just filled their pockets, eventually they would have to overflow, and then you and I, we could slit each other's throats for those crumbs.
Well, it hasn't been a river of gold, but it has been a yellow-colored river, for sure.
And I've been trickled out enough, but, you know.
It's been trickling down, yeah.
And look at this, Joshua Holland, this whole debate over this debt ceiling. I've been saying it's been a distraction from the beginning. This dog and pony show was just to take our mind away from the fact that we're not creating things. We have no manufacturing base, and it's our trade deficits that are the real problem here.
You know, that's such a good point, you know. People, I think, don't understand what a trade deficit means. It means that beyond the obvious that it's a deficit in the amount that we're selling abroad compared to what we're buying abroad, we finance our trade deficit through debt. And it may be a combination of public debt and private debt. It's not all the deficit. It doesn't all go to the public deficit. But there's no way around that mathematical reality. When you have this trade deficit, you finance that with national debt, personal and private and public. And, you know, we talk so much about this deficit hysteria. Nobody wants to talk about the elephant in the room, which is a massive, massive trade deficit. It's an imbalanced global economy. Now, it's important to understand that to some degree, we're starting to see this turning around the economy, the global economy balancing itself a little bit, despite the best efforts to allow GE to manufacture whatever it wants elsewhere and ship back for sale here. And that's largely due to dramatic increases in shipping costs. With oil priced the way it is,
right,
shipping costs have increased from the Asian countries to the United States by over 100% in the last 5 or 6 years. Wage pressure, the Chinese are looking for higher wages. Wages in China have gone up, I think, 40%+ in the last few years. And so we're starting to see this kind of balance out. The other thing that's happening is that, you know, there's a great problem with the Chinese currency, the way that they're keeping their currency artificially low against the dollar. And
as where we're keeping ours high.
And we have what's known as a strong dollar policy. And I talk about this in the piece that, you know, everybody in the establishment in Washington, the media, they assume that a strong dollar is good because strong is good and weak is bad.
Yep.
Right. That's more of a cultural
very
thing.
Very simple minded. Yep.
It's simple minded. It fits on a bumper sticker. But the reality is that a weaker dollar is exactly precisely what our economy needs right now. Now, why is that? It does two things in the right away. It makes foreign-produced goods more expensive relative to domestically produced goods.
Yep.
That is, it encourages job creation. You know, jobs are our fundamental problem right now. The other thing that it does is it brings down energy prices. We import a ton of oil. And so the idea that we need to be maintaining a strong dollar is very counterproductive to this moment in time, even if over the long term, when the economy eventually recovers, a strong dollar might be in our national interest.
Yeah, but here's the thing. They don't want that to happen. They don't want that fluctuation to happen because a weaker dollar is going to help people who are in debt, help them pay off their mortgages, help them pay off their credit cards. And the investor class here, they're not going to profit as much.
That's right. And you know who really hates a weaker dollar? Banks.
Oh, absolutely.
Anybody who lends out a strong dollar does not want to be repaid with a weaker dollar. They lose money in that transaction. So, you know, we know from all of our experience every day how much influence these interests have over the political discourse, and that's why we're not talking about it, and that's why we always hear that the idea that we could return manufacturing to the United States with a comprehensive industrial policy like many other countries have adopted is considered a fringe position. And people say that people saying this message are crazy and don't accept modernity and, you know, are paranoid about globalization. None of that is true. This is just a matter of adopting a sane and rational industrial policy that balances the interests of working people and investors.
Yeah, see, I'm all in favor of companies going around the globe as long as what they're producing is for domestic consumption. This I was at the Jobs with Justice conference, and a guy, and I don't remember what his name was, but he said, we don't want a seat at the table. We want a whole nother table. And that made perfect sense to me because, you know, this idea of free trade and the whole model that we're setting up on is completely backwards in my mind. All of the production that goes on should be for domestic consumption, and you trade those things that you possibly cannot make. We should be talking about that instead of having a system where everybody sets up their export model to import their stuff to the U.S., and we, the U.S. consumers, we're the consumer of last resort.
Okay, I'm gonna disagree with you very slightly in the following way. The entire trade regime, and we should never say free trade, right? We're protecting certain industries and freeing trade in other industries. The entire thing rests on the idea that one size fits all. That whether you're an economy that's based on producing rice or high-tech microchips, you should have more or less the same economic policies. And I think that that's nonsense, and that certain countries, I believe that democracy is more important than this trade ideology. And, you know, we're talking about international treaties that tie the hands of democratic legislatures so that they can't do what they feel, and it may change over time, is in the best interest of their own economies.
Right.
So I'm for getting rid of the one-size-fits-all regime, period. And allowing a lot more autonomy, economic autonomy. Look, there's good arguments for having trade between countries of goods and services. There's extremely good arguments for that. But you need to let countries regulate it. And that's, I think, the really key principle, is that the entire trade regime is a backdoor method of deregulation on a massive scale.
Yeah, as we were talking about in the last segment, the reality is, you know, these trade deals, the first thing that they have, especially NAFTA, the least restrictive trade barriers, least restrictive barriers. And that, basically, any law you pass can be challenged in these secret tribunals and basically can be overthrown.
Well, I think that's a really important point you make. A lot of people, when they think about trade, you know, international trade, what do they think about? They think about boats crossing the ocean with widgets or tennis balls or what have you. The point where trade became something that we had to worry about was not when they were talking about lowering tariffs on manufactured goods being traded by countries of similar economies. It was when they started to extend those same principles to what they called non-tariff barriers. Now, non-tariff barriers can be just about anything that have the effect, it doesn't matter if that was the intent, of privileging one country's products over another. So, you know, we have a lot of these famous cases. The United States decided that they wanted to pass a law that we wanted dolphin-safe tuna. We live in a democracy, and a lot of people wanted to have tuna that was fished with nets that didn't kill dolphins. Okay, we passed a law. That law had the effect. It was never an intended consequence to discriminate against other countries, tuna, but it had the effect of privileging tuna that was caught with dolphin-safe nets. And so they challenged it, and they got that overturned. They got that – it wasn't that they – it's not that they get it overturned. What they do is they challenge a country's law, and then these tribunals are able to basically punish the country for not changing their law.
And it's amazing how many people don't know that.
That's right. And it can be environmental protections. It can be worker protections. It can be – there's a whole host of non-tariff barriers. And when they started to extend the principles or the ideology of trade, of liberal trade, liberalizing trade, to these non-tariff areas, which you and I might call, you know, environmental regulations, that's when things became very worrisome. And again, these are processes that are opaque and conducted, you know, with a lot of influence from corporate lobbyists.
And there is my problem. And with these tribunals, you and I can't go watch what goes on. We don't even know who gets to sit on the panels. And that's a problem.
You know, even reading trade agreements is incredibly difficult. I was at the World Trade Organization meeting in Cancun in 2002, and I was talking to this trade attorney, and I said, this stuff, you know, I've read lots of legal briefs. I've read Supreme Court rulings, and I've read lots of contracts. I'm not a stupid person, and it's impenetrably dense. And he said, look, I'm a trade attorney. I've been trained in this for years. I've been a practicing trade attorney, and I don't understand half this stuff because they go out of their way to make it as complicated as they can in order to be opaque. You know, there's a great book called, Behind the Scenes of the WTO. And it shows just, you know, all of the kind of arm twisting that's done behind the scenes to get countries to sign on to these trade deals. You know, less affluent countries, less powerful countries, they literally take them into back rooms and threaten them, and you know, it's remarkable that we can even consider this anywhere in keeping with a free enterprise model.
Yeah, or they send in John Perkins, the guy who wrote The Confessions of an Economic Hitman, where he says, and when the new dictator came in, he came in with a briefcase full of cash and a bullet and said, pick one. So that's kind of, that's what he told me, so I'm just taking his word for it. Again, the piece is Make It in America, How We Can Bring Manufacturing Back. No, really. Written by Josh Holloman, editor and senior writer over at Alternet. Josh, always great talking with you. Love to have you back on again real soon.
A pleasure. Thanks, Rick.
We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Rick Smith.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make everything happen!
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
With the PSECU Home Equity Line of Credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got our rates so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender. Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Down, 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 and a fight when I burns, burns, burns.
to the Borowitz Report, evangelic preacher Pat Robertson sparked controversy today in his broadcast of the 700 Club by saying that yesterday's mild East Coast earthquake was God's revenge on people who act kind of gay. All across the Eastern Seaboard, Reverend Robertson said, there are men who get manicures, wear designer eyewear, and know about thread counts. God finds this somewhat gay-like behavior confusing, and he has responded by getting mildly peeved. The televangelist warned that if Americans persist in their seemingly sort of gay behavior, the country should brace itself for additional ambiguous acts of retaliation from the Almighty. Robertson said God will strike back at people who act sort of gay with all kinds of mild responses. If you keep getting pedicures and facials, you can expect 2 to 3 inches of rain and some really, really hot, humid days. Reverend Robertson said that the New Yorkers who reacted in an over-the-top way to yesterday's tremor run the risk of moderately annoying the Heavenly Father yet again. He said God looks at people who get their panties in a twist after a little shaking, and he says to himself, wow, that's really kind of gay. Elsewhere in Libya, an exit strategy was being discussed in which Muammar Gaddafi would relinquish all power but still be the mayor of Tripoli on Foursquare. So there you go, from the front page of the Borowitz Report. And, you know, the whole thing, this whole idea that you knew it was coming, so not to disappoint this Rabbi Levin, the guy who's the head of this national organization for marriage, he came out, yep. He said, yeah, it was the gay people who did it. The whole earthquake was because we have gay people. So very good for you. Very good for you, Rabbi. Good religious man. Now here's the thing. They can blame gay people. I don't. I'm not buying that whole thing. But my producer, he blames me. And look, I may have to take responsibility, because yesterday we were right about the exact time that someone was supposed to have a meeting on our behalf. The earthquake hit, so the meeting didn't happen. So it was one of these things that, it was my fault, because I have the absolute worst luck in the world. If it's going to go wrong, it's going to go wrong to me. I have this black cloud that follows over me, and I think it goes back to when my wife and I were first dating. We went to one of those little carnival things that they have, like, in town, and they had a fortune teller there. And when I walked up, she goes, oh, you have a dirty aura. I'm like, wow, that's not a very good pickup line. She goes, I can cure that. And for $35, you can buy this candle. And this candle will clear up your aura. And I'm like, nah, that's okay. I'll just pay my $5 and you can read my palm or do whatever it is. Now, ever since that happened, it's been like I've been cursed. Our house burned down, I blew out my knee, all kinds of really just bad stuff has happened. And now this, the earthquake that I caused, all because I didn't buy that one stupid candle. And every time something goes wrong, my wife goes, you should have bought the candle. So here again, if anyone knows this woman, because I think maybe it's time that I have to start looking into clearing up my aura, kind of like a teenage boy with acne. Maybe I got this aura problem where maybe the candle would have worked. I don't know. But I'll tell you, it's one of those funny things that whatever can go wrong, sometimes usually does. But in the end, it usually works out well. So I'm hoping that no more earthquakes. I'm hoping the meeting takes place as scheduled in the future. But it's a nice story. Should have bought the candle. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, you can go to thericksmithshow.com and download our podcast. It's there for your entertainment, your enjoyment. Also, if you got one of these nifty smartphones, you can download the Stitcher app, and we've got our program right there for you to take it with you on the go. We're going to take a quick break. Of course, during the break, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. We're right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You know it's all that we can do, change your mind.
Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees are playing an important role in the dedication of the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial in Washington. AFSCME Secretary Treasurer Lee Saunders says Dr. King was defending collective bargaining rights for AFSCME workers when he was killed.
We raised over $1 million to support the construction of the memorial site. He will be the first African-American honored in this way by having a monument on the mall. We are urging everybody to attend the festivities and to attend the dedication ceremonies, and more importantly, to rekindle the dream that Dr. King had.
Saunders says had he lived, Dr. King would have been marching alongside today's public workers.
And I think that he would have been in the front of those marches and in the front of those rallies that we had in Wisconsin and that we've had in Ohio and across the country, supporting the right to collective bargaining for public sector workers.
Warehouse Workers United's Shaharier Couchy says that after exposing health and safety violations, warehouse workers in Chino, California, have suffered retaliation from the employer. They're rallying today in Chino to protest that retaliation. The workers reported NFI Industries to California OSHA. After blowing the whistle, workers reported intimidation tactics, including threats to report immigration status, threats of job loss, and assignment changes. Couchy says that reporting the health and safety violations, though, has also resulted in some improved working conditions at the warehouses that move goods for major American retailers.
The company started pressuring workers less in terms of speed, in terms of the forklifts going fast, workers being told to work faster. They've been trained and told that they have the right to take breaks when it's really hot. They've been told that they have the right to drink water.
Demands for jobs are breaking out at congressional town halls across the country and even in districts where members aren't holding town halls. Jesse Russell reports.
Some representatives are skipping town halls altogether, such as Wisconsin's Representative Paul Ryan. 4 days in a row, seven unemployed constituents have shown up at Ryan's office in Kenosha when it opens and have waited for Ryan to show up. As of this morning, he still hasn't responded to requests for a meeting. Instead, Ryan is hosting a town hall at the local Rotary and asking for a payment of $15 to attend. Scott Page has been outsourced from two separate jobs over the last 3 years.
What a better way to get the unemployed population out of your hair so you could talk your agenda or whatever you're going to do. You know, you charge for the people to get in. I don't have $15 to ask Representative Ryan a question, so, I mean, this is the only means I have to talk to him.
Page says he'll stop showing up at Ryan's office as soon as the representative grants him a meeting. Some representatives are even trying to clamp down on potentially embarrassing videos of constituents challenging them for their job policies. Ohio Republican Representative Steve Chabot banned video cameras from his town halls. In one incident, security was recorded confiscating a cell phone from a senior citizen and moving on to take video cameras from other constituents.
This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Got something on your mind, question, comment, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Looks like a new public policy polling poll has come out, and it's got Governor Rick Perry of Texas with a double-digit lead over former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. You know, and as you're looking at this stuff, you know, I've been saying, you know, that you knew the flavor of the month was going to get a big boost. But I didn't know he'd get this big of a boost. He's got double-digit leads ahead of Romney. I thought he'd catch up and it'd be a little neck and neck, which is why Romney came out with this hit piece on workers. He needs to look as crazy as the rest of the field. And this is his attempt, you know, to pay homage to the extreme right. And, you know, maybe it's going to work. I don't know. I doubt it. I think the extreme right has already written him off. But in order to get this nomination, I think, you know, he's going to have to kowtow more towards them. And I think my guy in this is so far is Perry. I think he's the one to beat in this. because he's got the whole faith thing going that the radical Christian extreme right wants. He's tailoring his message to be an anti-tax guy. First he said, we're in his book, he said, well, we're not gonna do anything to get rid of the 16th Amendment. We're not gonna do anything to the current tax code. Not gonna do any of that. And now he's saying, well, you know what we need to do? We need to come out and do away with the 16th Amendment. So the book's 9 months old. So he wrote the book 9 months ago, and now he's walking away from that. He said, quote, in his book, this is right from the book, the 16th Amendment, instituting a federal income tax starting at 1% has exploded to erroneous, complex, and confusing tax rates and rules for American workers over the last century. We can't undo more than 70 years of progressive taxation and worsening debt obligations overnight. But now he's saying, get rid of it. Goodbye. The book was also critical of the 17th Amendment. I don't understand the extreme righties who want to do away with that. You mean you don't want to have say in who the senators are? You want to go back to the good old days where you only had to buy a couple of state legislators? Scary, scary stuff. The Washington Post reported, as we have a number of times, the governor of Texas, he's the guy who's presided over the most executions. 234. He's by far number one. Blew George W. Bush away. Basically everybody else in the dust. So Perry's very, very, very fond of that. I guess that religious thing doesn't have anything to do with executing people. But he was being interviewed, and I gotta play these clips because there's a part of me that just loved George W. Bush so much because he was a walking gaffe machine. He even made someone like me a comedian. All he had to do was open his mouth and you laughed. I mean, it was hysterical. And this guy, I think, is going to be even better because as where Bush knew he was stupid, I think this guy thinks he's some kind of genius, some kind of savant. He's even told you he's the prophet. But he was asked about abstinence only. And let me play the clip.
Why does Texas continue with abstinence education programs when they don't seem to be working? In fact, I think we have the third highest teen pregnancy rate in the country among all the states.
Abstinence works.
But we are the third highest teen pregnancy. We have the third highest teen pregnancy rate among all states in the country. The questioner's point is, it doesn't seem to be working. Abstinence education.
It works. Maybe it's the way it's being taught or the way that it's being applied out there. But the fact of the matter is, it is the best form of to teach our children.
Yeah, it's the best thing. It doesn't work. We know that. We're the third highest state in the country. All these failures. I mean, you got the Palin girl, all her life taught the abstinence only. Didn't quite work. It's just the way we're not teaching it right. See, it's just how it's taught. See, and I love this. Go talk about me. Go talk about my personal life.
Can you give me a statistic suggesting it works?
I'm just going to tell you from my own personal life, abstinence works. And the point is, if we're not teaching it, and if we're not impressing it upon them, then no. But if the point is, we're going to go stand up here and say, listen, y'all go have sex and go have the whatever is going on and we'll worry with that, and here's the ways to have safe sex. I'm sorry, you call me old-fashioned if you want, but that is not what I'm going to stand up in front of the people of the state of Texas and say that's the way we need to go and forget about abstinence.
This is the guy that wants to run the country. Now, understand, I mean, it's this very head-in-the-sand mentality. Look, I've got two daughters. When they get to be teenagers, do I want them, out there, having sex, being promiscuous? No. But I want them to be safe. And there's a difference between saying, I don't want this to happen. I don't want you to do this. I want you to wait. I want, I'd like you to think about holding off. And there's another thing saying, I want you to be safe. just because you're safe doesn't mean that you're condoning it. And this is where this huge diversion between this right-wing thought and the rest of us stands. I mean, you know, I'm not in favor of abortion either, but I want my daughters to be safe. And that is a concept I don't think the righties get. He goes on, and again, more hilarity and more just really baffling, twisted thought.
That's not what the, I mean, with respect, Governor, that's not what the questioner is asking. The questioner is simply saying we're spending money on abstinence education. We're the third highest teen pregnancy rate in the country. Is there a problem disconnect between one and the other?
I love this answer. Dead silence.
I don't know. Look, it gets in line with...
Here it comes.
It gets in line with other programs that we have that we spend money on, and do they work 100% or do they work 5%? And that's a bigger and a better issue than, well, we have the third highest teenage pregnancy rate.
This is the guy who wants to run the country. And there are people in this listening audience who will probably vote for this guy. Did you find anything in that you said, yeah, this is the guy I want running the country? No. In a state with the third highest rate, still buys it. It works. Abstinence only works. And I guess it depends on what you define as works. If you have a society of, you know, 16, 17-year-old girls who are now saddled with child and now part of a dependency class that they seem to abhor, maybe that's what they want. I don't know. Maybe they want to go back 50 years, 100 years, where women are barefoot and pregnant. Maybe that's the whole shtick. But understand, you know, as we move down, and as I've been talking about for some time, once they do away with Roe versus Wade, Griswold's next. And then women aren't going to be able to protect themselves. And there should not be a woman in this country. And you are the minority, ladies, who look at somebody like Perry and go, oh, yeah, he's my guy. Yeah. And I listened to that part where my personal laugh. The rumors running around Texas, and I've had a couple people email me say, you know, there's rumors down here in Texas that there are, you know, two things, steers and queers, and he may be one of, he ain't a steer. So I'm waiting for that to come out. So interesting stuff. Anyway, enough about Rick Perry. I got to be honest, he's just insane to me. Another Republican who's gotten himself in trouble and actually has resigned from his office, a New Jersey lawmaker, state representative, a guy named Pat Delaney. He's the guy running against Carl Lewis. And if you remember the whole thing with Carl Lewis, is there was a big legal battle to get him on the ballot. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on. So his wife, I guess, kind of all flipped off, and she wrote him an email saying, imagine not having to pay New Jersey state income tax. It must be nice. Imagine getting a court ruling overturned so your name could be put on the ballot. Imagine having dark skin and name recognition and the nerve to think that equaled knowing something about politics. Sure, knowing someone with fat purse strings is nice, but you have no knowledge. So, again, you know, kind of a dumb thing to say, you know. This is where it gets funny. I look at the guy who's, you know, defending his 8th district seat. Now he's basically humiliated, and he says, you know, I'm going to have to resign. He says, in an attempt to repair the serious damage that this has caused to our marriage and to protect our children from public humiliation, I've decided to leave public life. On behalf of my family, we sincerely apologize to Mr. Lewis for any pain that this caused him. And I'm going, you know, I can't imagine having to write that email saying I'm deeply disappointed in my wife's decision to email this guy. It doesn't reflect my beliefs whatsoever. And you go, I would love to be in the room when that whole argument happens. Again, you know, I look at this and I go, crazy. He understands the politic. And I would argue he's probably of that mindset. She didn't understand the politic. She thought, like teabaggers do, I could just spew my mind and nobody's not going to harm anybody. Well, you know what? Just screwed your husband. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
We have a problem. We need to solve it. This comment by House Speaker Shap Smith of Vermont reflects a no-nonsense, hands-on, can-do attitude you don't often find in legislatures these days. Instead, when most so-called leaders are confronted with a problem, they tend to say, we need to cover it up, or we need to turn it into a political football. But Smith and a big majority of his Vermont colleagues refuse to play games with one of the biggest issues confronting them and the people of every state. Affordable health care for all. They knew that the current high-cost, low-quality, you're-on-your-own system was literally killing people, even as it was draining the budgets of governments and businesses. Costs of health care in Vermont have doubled in the last decade to roughly $5 billion a year and continue to go up by $1 million a day, even as 47,000 Vermonters have no coverage and most others have only DGS health insurance. Don't get sick. Angry about this, a strong grassroots campaign for universal health care has been steadily building across Vermont, culminating this year in H-202. This bill would establish a state health exchange authorized to set up a single-payer-style health care system dubbed Green Mountain Care. The bill faced the usual opposition from special interests and know-nothings. One House Republican decried the very idea of universal coverage as, quote, the keystone in the arch of socialism. But with stout public support, Green Mountain Care passed the House 92-49 and the Senate 21-9. On May 26th, Governor Pete Shumlin, who had made this issue central in his campaign last year, signed the bill, making Vermont first in the nation to go to the core of reform by enacting a single-payer law. This is Jim Hightower saying, for information, go to VermontForSinglePayer.com.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember to check out the website, therickssmithshow.com, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425 if you've got something on your mind. So yesterday, the little shaker that happened, some are questioning if it has something to do with fracking, if it has something to do with the high-pressure injections that are going on in states across this region. Virginia apparently has 75 of these injection wells. Arkansas, for instance, has 1,000 of them, and they've had a bunch of earthquakes. They're saying somewhere around about 800 of these small earthquakes that they're saying probably has everything to do with the fact that you're pumping things underground at pretty high pressure. And I looked at the story in the area that, you know, asked the question, Marcellus drilling to blame for Virginia earthquake? No fracking way, industry official says. Big headlines, no fracking way. And I love the guy's quote, and I'm going to have to remember this. His name is Bob Whittle. His name's Whittle. He says it's like comparing apples and orangutans. Oh, that was clever. Very clever. He went on to say that, if Marcellus drilling caused an earthquake hundreds of miles away, then it also caused the Great Depression, the Black Plague, the October Revolution, and the breakup of the Beatles, according to this Chris Tucker of Energy In Depth, which is an oil and gas industry-based group in D.C. And I look at this and I'm going, circle the wagons much? We have seen since, you know, I remember writing a paper on this a while ago, that this injection wells were causing these earthquakes. The first one that I found was in the 60s. The Army were pumping chemical wastes from this Rocky Mountain Arsenal chemical plant in deep underground in Wrangley, Colorado. And they're finding, gee, we're having hundreds and hundreds of these earthquakes, you know, and seem to be commonplace. Gee, no one knows why. And they go, well, what are they doing out there at that Army base? Turns out they are pumping, you know, millions of gallons at such high pressure that, of course, you're having seismic activity. The tectonic plates were shifting a little bit. And, you know, at the time, they're going, well, we can't possibly. We could not possibly cause that kind of activity. We are not capable. Much like the same argument that we're hearing about climate change. Oh, well, we're not responsible for global warming. It's not us. We couldn't possibly. We're mere mortals. Yeah. We know this. You stick a needle in the ground, you start pumping stuff at high pressure, especially when you're on a fault, near a fault line. In Ohio, they've been having it for some time. And Ohio's got a whole bunch of these injection well sites. But they're also saying that this hydraulic fracking that's going on, where they shoot this stuff down in the ground and they put these chemicals in there to break up the rock down there. That's causing some things as well. You know, ever since the late 90s, they've been saying they learned that lesson in southeastern New Mexico because they had repeated earthquakes. And, you know, what's the common denominator? Let's think of this. Hold on. Oh, yeah, we're putting needles in the ground. And, you know, at the end of this, look, this is a price we may have to pay. You know, we should have this discussion. But the industry... the drillers and the natural gas and the oil people, they don't want to have this conversation at all. They're going to deny it. It's like apples and orangutans. Yes. You thought he was going to say oranges, but no, orangutans. They're going to deny, they're going to obstruct, they're going to set up front group after front group, and they're going to pay people to get out there, just like these couple of guys, to deny it completely. And, you know, the reality is we are seeing the natural gas industry, the drilling industry, explode before our very eyes. In fact, the USGS, they released a report Tuesday, ironically, that shows that the Marcellus Shale, the gas that they're getting, the recoverable gas that they're getting out of the Marcellus field, 84 trillion cubic feet. And that's up from just 2002 of only 2 trillion cubic feet. And they're saying that that's a 4,100% increase. So we're seeing a 4,100% increase in what's coming out of our ground. Should we expect some type of, you know, I'm just asking the question. And it's something we need to look into a little bit further. Because you're pumping all this stuff down. The gas is coming back up. You're doing something to the underground. Now to say, well, you know, we're incapable of causing any destruction. A little naive, I think. But, you know, we've bought into it. We've kind of bought into the whole idea on a certain frame that we're not capable of doing it. I'm saying we can. And on the other side of this, you know, maybe we have an earthquake every now and again. And, you know, natural gas burns cleaner. I'll agree. I think it's got to be the transition fuel that gets us off of coal and gets us off of oil. And I understand that. But what's it going to do in the process? What's going to happen as we move forward, as we move down the road? And now you're seeing in Allentown, they're reporting that up in Susquehanna County, there are three more of these wells and one of the ponds that are now contaminated with methane. And, well, gee, we don't know anything about that. And the fact is, the water, the wells, they're located right there. And they're operated by this Cabot Oil and Gas Company, who, you know, they've endured some pretty harsh criticism, according to the reports. Because guess what? you've got other contaminated wells in the area. And, you know, I just think that at some point you need to be at least a little bit honest and say that we're going to have these problems. We're going to have to figure out how to fix it. And we're going to have to figure out what to do with the millions and millions of gallons of frac fluid that comes out, because it's we're using all of this water. And as I've talked about a number of times, I think at some point in the future, we're going to be fighting wars over water. And what we're doing is we're adding sand and a whole bunch of proprietary chemical mixtures in with the water to pump underground, to cause explosions, to get this these fractures to happen so the gas can come out. It's going to do some damage. That, I think, is common sense. I'd love to have somebody try and explain to how that isn't going to do any damage, and how, gee, you know, this high pressure injection doesn't cause any damage, doesn't make any of the plates to shift. And you look at where some of our nuke plants are, the one in Virginia, actually on a fault line. You know, was there any thought that went into that? Anybody really, you know, kind of think that through? Not so much. So I find it interesting that the industry, again, duck and cover. You know, just like Hershey did, duck and cover. Hopefully it'll blow over. But the drillers, they got it down to a science. They've got front groups out there. They got their spokespeople, their little think tanks. They spend hours and days and months spending boatloads of money focus testing things. They got their little think tank people writing things. You know, so they've got it down. You know, focus group tested, think tank approved. And that's the messaging mechanism. Yet, you and I, we may have to endure a little shaking every now and then, maybe a building come down on top of us, who knows. And we get fire water. And, you know, some people thought, you know, fire water. Funny joke. I saw the movie Gasland. I saw the guy turn on his spigot, and I saw him light his water on fire. I don't think I want my children drinking out of that tap. But it's something we're going to have to discuss, and it's something we're going to have to get to the bottom of. This just amazing stuff. But we've got a governor here who thinks that the Marcellus Shale and not taxing it and not doing anything, that's a good thing for the jobs. And I came across on his website under the heading of Rebuilding Pennsylvania, Promises Made, Promises Kept. With the heading of job creation, putting hard-working Pennsylvanians back to work. And this is what it said on the website. Governor Corbett is committed to supporting policies that support local business and their workers. This begins with a balanced state budget that holds the line on spending and on taxes. Got to get that political stuff in there. The Corbett budget looks at Pennsylvania's economy in the long term and begins the process of ensuring a stable, secure future for the Commonwealth. It means taking the first step towards tort reform by enacting the Fair Share Act. Oh, yeah. And ensuring that our legal system treats businesses and medical professionals fairly in the award of financial damages, working to keep them in Pennsylvania. So then we'll continue to create jobs and provide medical services. And finally, they say, Governor Corbett, the administration supports the growing and emerging industry of the Commonwealth, such as natural gas, because we're not going to tax them. We're not going to do anything. I look back and I'm going, well, what of that really creates jobs? The Marcellus Shale has created some. Most of the folks from outside the state, if you look at the hiring numbers. But the Fair Share Act, how does that create jobs here? To me, what that does is it puts us on a race to the bottom. Basically, anyone who is harmed in this state, you're screwed. And you could end up on the back of the taxpayers, which to me, I look at that and I go, the taxpayers are on the hook here. Or are we going to be like Texas? Because our governor loves the idea of, well, you know, we want to look like Texas. We'll be like Texas. Who passed loser pay tort reform. So if you're harmed, and you sue, and by some stretch you lose, you have to pay all of the fees. You have to pay everything. So let's say, you know, you got into an accident, and you can't work anymore. And you have to go and you have to sue, and you have to, you know, who knows what happens. You're done. And that's what they want for our legal system. They want it out of the reach of you and me. They want to use it to keep us in place, but they don't want it used to keep them accountable. And that's part of what this fair share thing is. And down in Texas, that whole loser pays tort reform. See, that's a good thing. Makes perfect sense. Until you stop and think about it, how many of you and I who would be harmed by a product, who would be harmed by a service, who could be hurt at work, who could be hurt in a car accident, whatever it is. How many of us could then afford out of our pocket to risk going after and making things right? Especially when you're talking about product liability. And that's really what that's about. Making sure that whatever products are sold, whatever products are used, never comes back in the way of lawsuits, because they've already done away with class lawsuits. No more of that. No more class action suits. Fix that remedy. You got to do that stuff individually. So it's the most costly, and it's the most time-consuming, and it's the most difficult. That's the point. Put up these massive hurdles. And that's what the business-friendly people want. Very, very simple. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Victoria Jones from Talk Radio News Service right back after this.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make everything happen!
The Rick Smith Show. Where working people come to talk.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
Big news of the day, Steve Jobs.
Stepping down as Apple CEO. He has been ill.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how much time do you think he's got left?
Very hard to tell, because nobody really knows. He was diagnosed with a rare form of pancreatic cancer in 2004, underwent a liver transplant 2 years ago, but he hasn't commented on his health since he said in a letter in January that he was taking another leave of absence to focus on my health. And he said in his resignation letter, "I have always said if there ever came a day when I could no longer meet my duties and expectations as Apple CEO, I would be the first to let you know. Unfortunately, that day has come."
Yeah, well, you know, here again, you know, if there's any cure out there, he's got enough money to find it.
And apparently has not. Well, so far.
I hope nothing but the best for him and anyone else in that situation, regardless of who they are.
Absolutely. I mean, what an extraordinary talent. What brilliance. What a change the world.
Yep. What's going on in Libya tonight?
Well, we have Gaddafi forces fighting still. Gaddafi's son apparently offering to broker a Libya ceasefire sent an email to CNN's Nick Robertson, has been exchanging emails with CNN's Nick Robertson. This is Saadi Gaddafi. But whether he actually has the power within the Gaddafi family to do this brokering is interesting. I don't know whether he does. He's never been one who's been considered one of the most powerful sons.
Right.
So it's interesting that he is, in fact, doing that.
And what I find interesting, he's going through CNN.
Yes, isn't that interesting? Can you imagine how Fox and the others have to be spitting?
Well, I mean, you wouldn't go to Fox.
No, he wouldn't go to Fox, but you think he might go to Al Jazeera.
Yeah, or something along those lines. But at the end of all of this, nothing good can come of this if you're going to broker a deal with one of the Gaddafi sons.
No, and you don't even know if it's real.
Nah, I mean, it could be a troll. You never know. Have they any idea where he is? I mean, you know, in this Where's Waldo game, any idea where he's at?
Well, they don't know where Saadi is, and they certainly don't know where Gaddafi is. In fact, the transitional council says that Libyan businessmen have put forward $1.7 million, the equivalent thereof, as a bounty on Gaddafi's head to get him. Because, you know, this thing, they want this thing over.
Right. Well, because it's bad for business. You know, no profits can be made while the country's in the middle of a civil war.
No, they want to rebuild the country.
And I would have to assume that the business types would want him out so that they can, you know, they can get a hold of the private function, make those public functions theirs. They can, you know, grab a hold of the oil and all of that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and not only the big businesses, but just the little businesses, the mom and pops, you know, the coffee shops, the fruit stands, they want to get going. You can't run a fruit stand if you've got a bunch of 15-year-olds with automatic rifles running around, letting them off in jubilation.
Yeah, well, good point. So let me ask you, how'd you do yesterday in the big quake? Some of the things that I saw from the West Coast, on the West Coast, they're laughing at us.
Well, they can laugh. You know, they can laugh, but 5.8, 5.9, I felt it. I was in a Starbucks on K Street, which is very Washington, right down in the lobbying heart of D.C., and I felt it. It didn't feel huge to me. I've lived out on the West Coast. It didn't feel huge to me, but I noticed it, and I went out onto the sidewalk with the rest of Washington, and it was chaotic down there, and one of the things that you noticed was that you couldn't use your phone.
And what happened? Because we had the same problem here. We, you know, we're some distance away. We had cell phone problems here.
And it seems that the cell phone networks are not up to this. They're just not up to this. And the concern is that this is the nation's capital. We know it's a target of every lunatic terrorist in the world. Because why not? You know, it's going to pick a target, pick this one.
Sure.
And so in the event of a real disaster, because this was like a pretend disaster,
right,
except for the, you know, the Washington Monument and the National Cathedral that really got damaged, and there was damage, but nobody got hurt, really.
No buildings fell, you know, no massive fires.
No, there was nothing major. But there certainly could be. And in that event, nobody could get through to anybody on their phones. So there are a lot of questions being asked about what could be done about this, because this is not really acceptable.
Because originally I just thought everybody at that very moment reached for their cell phones and decided there's got to be somebody who cares if I'm okay. I got to call somebody.
Right.
And I thought maybe it just jammed up transmission. You know, everybody all at once overloaded the system. But what you're saying and what I've seen, there's some structural problems here.
Right. And it wasn't just minutes. It went on for hours. So everybody wasn't trying for hours.
Yeah. We kept trying, and, well, you know, it was what it was. But here again, you know, how much regulation, how much oversight has gone into this industry springing up? When they throw up these towers, you know, is there any thought to this going in, going forward? And did they think about earthquakes? Did they think about things when they threw this all together? Do you know?
That's a very good question.
See,
I think the answer probably is some, but possibly not enough.
They probably threw it up as fast as they could, and, well, yeah, this is what we get. So maybe we'll fix it going forward. Eric Holder in the news.
Yes, he met today with the families of victims of 9/11 because he had promised to do so, because he wanted to give them an update on the FBI's investigation into possible phone hacking by News Corporation. And basically what he had to tell them was that there isn't any proof so far in the investigation that there has been hacking going on. That's how far they've got anyway, that they don't have any proof. Now, that doesn't mean to say that the investigation's over. One man who was there, retired New York firefighter Jim Riches, whose firefighter son died at the World Trade Center, said if anyone is held accountable, corporations can be fined and the people who should have known or who did the hacking could be put in jail. But there's no timeline for the investigation. So it is going forward, but they haven't got anything yet.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what they come up with. Personally, I got to think that some shenanigans went on because, sometimes you get a little overeager, I guess. And then,
yes.
You look at what
and it's moving forward in England. I mean, there's just more and more arrests, and it's really coming down over there.
Well, aren't their laws are a lot different than ours. I mean, it's a lot easier to do to arrest these people and to do things to them than it is here.
Yes, it is. It is easier to arrest them, but I mean, the noose is tightening. I'm not sure who it's tightening on yet. I don't know if it's tightening on James Murdoch yet. A lot is going to depend on whether the journalist who went to jail, when he actually when they hear from him in the next few weeks, which they will. He is being forced to say who it was who told him to hack.
Now, I'm sure there's a lot of money being shuffled around to make him fit the story that's going to keep Rupert and all the rest of them out of hot water.
I don't know. This is a court document.
We will see, and I'm looking forward to that. Lastly, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs are out still on the trail. What's going on there?
Michelle Bachmann is going to release her own health care plan.
Oh, boy.
Yes.
I'm sure it's, take two aspirins and pray.
And Mitt Romney's going to release his own jobs plan.
Oh, boy. He released his jobs plan. We're going to make every state in the country a right-to-work state.
So there
we can exploit labor and we can cheat people out of wages and, bring back the whip. That might help productivity. You just have the boss behind you cracking the whip behind you.
You just love them, don't you?
There isn't one of the Republicans that I can palate, to be honest. I wish there were. I wish there were someone I could look at and say, you know what? He's a decent guy. I used to like George Voinovich. There were some Republicans that were reasonable. This Klan, this cabal, these are people who are not Republicans. They're way out to the extreme. I watched Ben Stein on with, what's his name, O'Reilly. And yeah. Stein looks sane.
Wow.
I mean, it's how far this party has gone to the extreme for the last 30 years. Really scary. Scary stuff. Victoria Jones, I appreciate the time. Appreciate the update. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
Changing America for the better.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S.
Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner error, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickschmithshow.com.
The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, if you want to email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com, I do answer all emails personally. And I look at this WikiLeaks thing, and the more we hear about it, the more I'm going, thank goodness, I'm glad that this stuff's out in the open, and we should have more transparency, and we should have more accountability. Because now we find out from what was leaked that McCain, the Republican from Arizona, traitor Joe Lieberman, the Republican from Connecticut, and Lindsey Graham, the Republican from South Carolina, a couple years ago they were in Tripoli meeting with Muammar Gaddafi and saying, you know what, hey, you know, things are going okay. We're going to mend our ways. You know, we're going to come together. Because if you remember, he gave up his it was the big thing during the Bush years. Gaddafi's going to give up his nuclear ambitions. And, you know, I think everybody agreed that he was nowhere near, was never going to happen, but they needed the PR. They needed the stunt. They needed the messaging that, oh, well, you know, he's afraid, so going to give it up. And, you know, part of me goes, I'd love to know how much money we gave him. He's probably, you know, at the Bush Ranch right now, for all we know. But here's the thing. We're now finding out because of this WikiLeaks stuff, that the three of these guys were willing to sell him arms. And I'm going, you know, because I guess Libya needs some equipment. So they got some stuff they need for their airplanes, for their military. And we were, I guess McCain was right on board with that. And if you remember, Lieberman called Libya, you know, they're an ally in the war on terror. Important. They're an important ally in the war on terror. They also noted that the common enemies sometimes make better friends. And I'm going kind of cozy. And that's why I'm telling you, I think these people, these WikiLeaks folks, are absolute heroes. And I'm just right there. The more of this stuff we find out, the more of these backroom deals that we find out about, I say good. Because maybe the next time they decide they're going to pull some shenanigans, maybe we know about it and we can stop it before we end up fighting more wars, before we end up in more conflicts, before our kids end up shedding more blood. And I think Buffett was spot on. You know, his class has been coddled while they send our class off to bleed. And it takes me back to the Smedley Butler piece, War's a Racket. You know, the basic premise is, you know, war makes rich people richer and poor people dead. And I suggest anyone who has not read that, just to Google Major General Smedley Butler, or Google War is a Racket. It's a very quick read, very short. I think it's like 16 pages, but it lays it out. You know, he tells you, I was a thug for the bank boys, the sugar interests. I was the guy. And like I was talking with Josh Holland, when we had John Perkins on the program, the guy who wrote Confessions of an Economic Hitman. He said we'd go into these petty dictators who had just taken over, much like Libya is gonna end up with at some point, somebody else in the seat of power. And he said I'd walk into the room with a briefcase full of cash and a bullet. And I'd say, pick one. And generally they took them. They took the briefcase full of cash. And then we did business. And that's how they open up these third world, these kind of countries. Cause it's all about the cash, man. It's all about getting the big investors in and the big multinationals in to rape the land and exploit the workforce. That's what it's about. And you and I, we're still distracted. They give us bread and circus or American Idol and Cheetos, whatever you want. Here's an interesting story. I found out that I am in the top 10% of citizens in this country. I am. And I never thought of myself as a top 10%er. Lord knows my income is nowhere near that. But, you know, when it comes to using the little computer thingy, evidently, as the headline reads, 90% of Americans can't search an e-document. And I always thought, you know, you go to edit, you click on edit, you go down, you say find, and boom, you find what's in the document. Evidently, no. Most people can't do it. Control F, most people, that I didn't know you could use the simple Control F, even though it's right there for me. Even though it's right there for me. But I'm one of the 10%ers. Hooray for me. And now you know. And this is the reason I bring this up. Educational program as well. We're not just talking about politics. A little bit of useful information, for your own day-to-day computer work. You don't have to thank me. Just send money. But again, top 10%er. Hooray for me. This story ought to make my producer very happy. In Bristol, Tennessee, police said workers at a funeral home called the police because there were two people sleeping in the caskets that were in the storage area. At the Weaver's funeral home there in Bristol, they discovered the folks there about 10:30 in the morning yesterday. Suspects fled through a window, but you know they're still there. But they slept in the in the caskets. I'm going, really? You can't think of a better place to lay your head than I couldn't do it, could not do it. But our producer, his brother, evidently didn't leave his car locked somewhere near L.A. Right? Somewhere near L.A. And he came out, I guess, to check something, and there was a homeless guy sleeping in his back seat. So I guess, you know, here you go. The funeral home is saying that these two guys caused more than $9,000 in damage to the caskets. And I'm going, really, $9,000? I can understand that they smelled, that they probably hadn't showered, they stunk a little bit, but $9,000? Again, highway robbery, which is why I told my wife, when it's my turn, if you can put me out with the trash, with the recyclables, that's the way to go. Or, you know, maybe there's one of those body farms that'll take, you know, pay you by the pound. That's probably a good way to go. But definitely, none of these metal boxes costing $20,000. It's just such a waste. And these guys prey on you. Speaking of death, we now find out who the woman was who was killed with the gun at the gun shop. Turns out there's a former local radio personality, a guy named Bob Alexander. He is the husband of the woman who got shot. I'm not going to give his real name, but he was a former, he was on the big station here and a couple others around. They don't know what the investigation hasn't concluded, but it has been ruled a homicide. Now understand, you know, look, there's two things, there's accident and there's homicide. And they're saying that the homicide was what they had to choose because homicide means dying at the hands of another human being. So the prosecutor here in the area is not saying how he's going to go. We're going to wait till the investigation is finalized before any charges are filed. Look, there's got to be something. mishandling a firearm, something. There's got to be something. You just don't shoot people. And I understand it's going to be heartbreaking. But at the end of the day, there's a message that has to be sent to society. Or we're going to get some enterprising gentleman or woman, or, you know, hey, there's a good way of offing my spouse and not getting caught. So I'm waiting to see that something has to come out of this. I was looking at this story from WHDH-TV in Boston, somewhere up in New Hampshire. A 21-year-old guy was at a supermarket with his baby in the stroller, three-month-old daughter in the stroller. And he decided that, gee, you know, I'm going to stuff about $20 worth of baby food into the child's diaper bag and leave the store. Well, as soon as he got to the sidewalk, police stopped the 21-year-old man, and the fight or flight thing took over, and he decided to flee. Now, the problem is he left the baby there on the sidewalk. He's being held now on $1,000 cash bail. Turns out his wife was in the store as well. She has been charged as a co-conspirator. And I'm going, you know, how can she be charged? She wasn't anywhere near it because, as I read the report, they were completely far apart. The baby now has been left, with the grandmother. And, you know, I look at this and I go, he was stealing baby food. There's part of me that goes, I kind of feel for him. The economy's tough. You got to feed the kid, but you don't go run off and leave the kid. I just don't, not getting that one. And when I watch the news report, people really beat up on him for that. But, you know, not getting the point that, you know, the economy's tough and he was trying to steal food for the kid. Interesting thing. Did you see the Glenn Beck thing? Did anybody see it? Probably not. Evidently he went to Israel and he was going to have some big rally. I was listening a little bit this morning, you know, them talk about the rally that he was actually doing. And it was very much hero worship, and you got to give them credit. They do worship the Almighty there. I found it interesting, though, them talking about this rally that Beck was putting together is, you know, about bringing religions together, especially when he's a guy who really has spent a lot of time attacking Muslims. One of the guys who's, you know, been right out on the front of this whole Islamophobic fervor, one of the guys out really, really stirring the pot. I find that interesting. And you're saying, well, you know, we're trying to mend the faiths. Kind of strange to me. And now what they're saying is, well, you know, we had thousands of people there, 40,000 people there, 25,000 people here, thousands. The pictures I'm seeing, maybe half full. You know, they're saying that, well, you know, they're scalping tickets and, you know, no. I mean, what they're putting out is basically Fox News nonsense. But from all the photographs and the video that I've seen, nowhere near half. Most of the seats were empty. Just not getting them. They said the rhetoric was, you know, ridiculous. And there were more protesters than there were people who paid to get in. I find that kind of funny, considering this is his, you know, big thing. He's going to go off on TV. I hope somebody paid him the $4.95 to watch it on his channel, because he needs it. He needs it. Interesting news coming out of Washington. Evidently, Bill Clinton is now a vegan. And do you care? I don't. Another story, Jacksonville, Florida. And you gotta love Florida. Florida always comes up with some good stuff. They quarantined, the Jacksonville, City Hall. They had everything quarantined off and everybody evacuated the building, called in all the bomb squad and all the folks. Cause evidently there was a suspicious package that was left. Turns out it was a box of light bulbs. Someone had left the light bulbs, you're going to go do some work, set the light bulbs down. Someone reported it. When they scanned the box, turned out it had wires inside, light bulbs. And so they basically shut down the entire operation for 3 hours because of
light bulb.
There you go. Last story of the night. Well, maybe not. Well, you'll have to save that for tomorrow. Well, we'll be back here at 9 p.m. tomorrow night. If you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the Buddha sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming to the USP.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.